Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
As we bring you part two of our interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Isabel Wilkerson, her new book grows out of her widely acclaimed book, The Warmth of Other Suns, which tells the history of the Great Migration when waves of African Americans moved out of the South to escape racism, terrorism, and so much more, only to face it again in the North. In this new book, Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents, Isabel Wilkerson argues that America's racial hierarchy should be thought of as a caste system similar to what she calls the world's most recognized caste system in India. And she looks at Nazi Germany borrowing from Jim Crow laws of the United States. But before we go into all of that, it is so fascinating that your book, where you look at the United States, you look at India, you look at this issue of caste, and you look at African Americans in this country, at this time when Kamala Harris has just been chosen by Joe Biden to be the vice presidential running mate. She has an unusual biography. She's the first African-American woman to run on a major presidential ticket. But her mother is from India. She is African-American and the first Indian-American. In light of all this, could you talk about your response to the choice of Kamala Harris as vice presidential candidate?
Well, this is truly a groundbreaking moment in American history. It has taken 244 years for a woman of color, a woman of African descent, a woman of Indian descent to rise to the level of being a candidate on a major party ticket in the United States. So this is this represents so much intersectionality in our own personal story, but also so many longstanding barriers that are being crossed today.
So that brings us to, I mean, this joining together of these two issues. In your book, Caste, you write about Bhimrao Ambedkar, the intellectual leader of India's Dalit movement, what people call the untouchable movement. He wrote to W.E.B. Du Bois in 1946, "There is so much similarity between the position of the untouchables in India and of the position of the Negroes in America," he wrote. Can you talk about who he was in relation to Gandhi in India, and then W.E.B. Du Bois's response?
Well, Gandhi was from a family that was one of the upper castes. And so he was the leader in the effort toward independence for the entire country of India, and is known obviously for his nonviolent approach to achieving independence and to protesting. Dr. Ambedkar was a leader of the Dalit movement. He was born into what was then known or called as one of the untouchables, one of the groups that was viewed as untouchable. And he went on to achieve great heights in his education. He actually attended Columbia University, and he got many advanced degrees. And then he returned to lead the movement toward, first of all, the Indian Constitution, but then also continuing to advocate on behalf of his people. And he is an example of how people in India, particularly those who had been assigned to the lowest caste, had been looking and aware of what was going on across the oceans, across continents, of what was going on here in the United States, and made common cause or recognized the common cause between the plight of the Dalits, formerly known as untouchables, and of African Americans here in this country. So Dr. Ambedkar reached out to W.E.B. Du Bois, who was at that time obviously one of the leaders of African American intellect and thought and philosophy, reached out to him in recognition of the connections between the two peoples and the two countries in terms of the hierarchies. Both of them recognized that hierarchy, the infrastructure of our divisions, a caste system was an appropriate term to look at how both peoples were being treated in their respective societies. Though the countries are very, very different, they share somewhat in the ways of subordinating the very lowest caste people in their countries.
Context of White Supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, September 24, 2020. So I have been told. Oof. I was not excited to read this book. I am much more excited to read it now with a critical eye. Anybody out there, if you think you should read a book just because it is written by a victim of white supremacy who is classified as black, and applaud and clap regardless of what they have to say, if it's accurate, inaccurate, if they name call other black people, it doesn't matter, that we should just say it's great just because it's written by a black person, this is not the book club for you. This is a critical assessment, again, because I have concluded one of the ways that white people practice racism, white supremacy, is that they publish books that are not accurate about white supremacy racism. This is one of them. CASED, The Origins of Our Discontents. I am pronouncing it CASED deliberately. The audio segment that you heard at the beginning, that was from Isabel Wilkerson, her visit to my BFF Amy Goodman in August of this year, right after the book was published, and you heard one of the very first comments that they get to, hey, isn't that interesting? You have this book about racism, CASED, and it just happens to deal with the treatment of Negroes in the United States and Indians across the pond, and hey, look who got chosen for a VP. What do you think, Miss Wilkerson? I am pronouncing it CASED deliberately. You don't CASED a ballot, you CAST a ballot for Trump or Biden and Kamala Harris. Anywho, I'm just going to mention again, she does mention the Rona in this book, social distancing and all, which means this book was published, or at least portions of it were written, very recently. Kamala Harris was not just in the mix for VP, she was actually running for president way before the Rona even. So, lots to be said. Anyway, cowbell. We can marinate in that a lot because that is going to come up directly in the book. But I'm just going to go back. She had a quote on page 20. I highlighted this already. Now that I know Isabel Wilkerson was married to Brett Hamilton, suspected race soldier who apparently died sometime, I forgot, some years back. But the sentence that any of us manages to create abiding connections across these manufactured divisions is a testament to the beauty of the human spirit. That is the type of guess who's coming to dinner.
All we need is a voluntary, free-spirited, open-ended program of procreative racial deconstruction.
Everybody just got to keep fucking everybody till they're all the same color.
Nonsense that has been promoted throughout the system of white supremacy. The goal is not for little white boys and little black boys to hold hands together, metaphor. The goal is not to have abiding connections with white people. The goal is to replace white supremacy with justice. Then we can be friends. That's doing things logically. But now that I know she was married to a white person, oh, and that's going to come up explicitly in the text, oh, to her dead white man. Oh. Cowbell, and let us proceed critically. Context of white supremacy. CASED, The Origins of Our Discontent.
Found it.
Audio segment 1.
Chapter 7. through the fog of Delhi to the parallels in India and America. The flight to India landed in a gray veil that hid the terminal and its tower at the International Airport in Delhi. It was January 2018, my first moments on the subcontinent. The pilot searched for a jetway through the drapery of mist. It was 2 in the morning, and it was as if we had landed in a steam kettle. We're still airborne in a cloud, the night air pressing against cabin windows, and we could see nothing of the ground. I had not heard of rain in the forecast and was fascinated by this supernatural fog in the middle of the night until I realized that it was not fog at all, but smoke from coal plants, cars, and burning stubble trapped in stagnant wind. The pollution was a shroud at first to seeing India as it truly was. At daybreak, the sun pushed through the haze, and once I connected with my hosts, I raced along with them to cross an intersection, an open stretch of asphalt, with cars hurtling in every direction, with no lanes or speed limits. We made our way along the side streets to the conference we were attending. I saw the wayside altars and mushroom temples with their garlands and silk flowers to the Hindu deities at the base of the sacred fig trees. There, commuters can pause for reflection as they head to work, or an exam, or a doctor's visit. The sidewalk shrines seemed exotic to me until I thought of the American ritual of spontaneous altars of flowers and balloons at the sight of something very different, at the sight of an accident or tragedy, as for the young woman killed at the infamous rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, just months before. Both reflect a human desire to connect with and honor something or someone beyond ourselves. The United States and India are profoundly different from each other in culture, technology, economics, ethnic makeup. And yet many generations ago, these two great lands paralleled each other, both protected by oceans and ruled for a time by the British, fertile and coveted. Both adopted social hierarchies and abide great chasms between the highest and the lowest in their respective lands. Both were conquered by people said to be Aryans arriving, in one case, from across the Atlantic Ocean, in the other, from the north. Those deemed lowest in each country would serve those deemed high. The younger country, the United States, would become the most powerful democracy on earth. The older country, India, the largest. Their respective hierarchies are profoundly different, and yet, as if operating from the same instruction manual, translated to fit their distinctive cultures, both countries adopted similar methods of maintaining rigid lines of demarcation and protocols. Both countries kept their dominant caste separate, apart, and above those deemed lower. Both exiled their indigenous peoples, the Adivasi in India, the Native Americans in the United States, to remote lands and to the unseen margins of society. Both countries enacted a fretwork of laws to chain the lowliest group, Dalits in India and African Americans in the United States, to the bottom, using terror and force to keep them there. Perhaps only the Jews have as long a history of suffering from discrimination as the Dalits, wrote the Dalit journalist V.T. Rajshekhar. However, when we consider the nature of the suffering endured by the Dalits, it is only the African-American parallel of enslavement, apartheid, and forced assimilation that comes to mind. Both countries have since abolished the formal laws that defined their caste systems. The United States in a series of civil rights laws in the 1960s, and India decades before in the 1940s. But both caste systems live on in hearts and habits, institutions and infrastructures. Both countries still live with the residue of codes that prevailed for far longer than they have not. This description of caste history from the 2017 Indian book Ground Down by Growth could be said of the American caste system with only a few word changes. the colonial powers officially abolished slavery in India. We could replace the word India with the United States. In 1843, or in the case of the United States, 1865. But this simply led to its transformation into bondage through relations of debt, what has been called debt peonage by scholars. In both countries and at the same time, the lowest castes toiled for their masters. African Americans in the tobacco fields along the Chesapeake or in the cotton fields of Mississippi, Dalits plucking tea in Kerala and cotton in Nandurbar. Both worked as enslaved people and later for the right to live on the land that they were farming. African Americans in the system of sharecropping, Dalits in the Indian equivalent known as Saldari. Both still confined to their fixed roles at the bottom of their respective worlds. Both occupy the lowest positions on the status hierarchies in their societies, wrote Harvard political scientist Sidney Verba and his colleagues in a study of Dalits and African Americans. Both have been particularly singled out from other groups based on characteristics ascribed to them. While doors have opened to the subordinated castes in India and in America in the decades since discrimination was officially prohibited, the same spasms of resistance have afflicted both countries. What is called affirmative action in the United States is called reservations in India, and they are equally unpopular with the upper castes in both countries, language tracking in lockstep, with complaints of reverse discrimination in one and reverse casteism in the other. There are many overarching similarities, but they are not the same in how they are structured or operate. The American system was founded as a primarily two-tiered hierarchy, with its contours defined by the uppermost group, those identified as white, and by the subordinated group, those identified as black, with immigrants from outside of Europe forming blurred middle castes that sought to adjust themselves within a bipolar structure. The Indian caste system, by contrast, is an elaborate fretwork of thousands of subcastes, or jatis, correlated to region and village, which fall under the four main varnas: Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Shudra, and the excluded fifth, known as untouchables or Dalits. It is further complicated by non-Hindus, Muslims, Buddhists, and Christians, who are outside the caste system but have incorporated themselves into the workings of the country and, while eschewing rigid caste, may or may not have informal rankings among themselves and in relation to the varnas. Unlike the United States, which primarily uses physical features to tell the castes apart, in India it is people's surnames that may most readily convey their caste. Dalit names are generally contemptible in meaning, referring to the humble or dirty work they were relegated to, while the Brahmins carry the names of the gods. Generally, you must know the significance of the name, learn the occupation of their forefathers, and perhaps know their village or their place in the village to ascertain their caste. But after centuries of forced submission and in-group marriage, they may also be identified by their bearing, accents, and clothing, all of which, over the centuries, were required to be lowly and menial, as well as a tendency to be darker than upper caste people, though not always. The Indian caste system is said to be stable and unquestioned by those within it, bound as it is by religion and in the Hindu belief in reincarnation, the belief that one lives out in this life the karma of the previous ones, suffers the punishment or reaps the rewards for one's deeds in a past life, and that the more keenly one follows the rules for the caste they are born to, the higher their station will be in the next life. Some observers say that this is what distinguishes the Indian caste system from any other, that people in the lowest caste accept their lot, that it is fixed and unbending, that Dalits live out their karma decreed by the gods and do their lowly work without complaint, knowing not to dream of anything more. In order to survive, some people in a subordinated caste may learn and believe that resistance is futile. But this condescending view disregards generations of resistance, as well as the work of Ambedkar and the reformer Jyotipa Phule before him. It was also wrongly assumed of enslaved Africans, and it disregards a fundamental truth of the species, that all human beings want to be free. The Dalits were no more contented with their lot than anyone would be. In a caste system, conflating compliance with approval can be dehumanizing in itself. Many Dalits looked out beyond their homeland, surveyed the oppressed people all over the world, and identified the people closest to their lamentations. They recognized a shared fate with African Americans, few of whom would have known of the suffering of Dalits. Some Dalits felt so strong a kinship with one wing of the American civil rights movement and had followed it so closely that in the 1970s, they created the Dalit Panthers, inspired by the Black Panther Party. A few years ago, a group of African American professors made a trip to a rural village in Uttar Pradesh, India. There, hundreds of villagers from the lowliest subcaste, the scavengers, came together for a ceremony to welcome the Americans. The villagers sang Dalit liberation songs for the occasion. Then they turned to their American guests and invited them to sing a liberation song of their own. A law professor from Indiana University, Kenneth Dow Schmidt, began a song that the civil rights marchers sang in Birmingham and Selma before they faced sheriff's dogs and water hoses. As he reached the refrain, the Dalit hosts joined in and began to sing with their American counterparts. Across the oceans, they well knew the words to "We Shall Overcome." Chapter 8. The Nazis and the Acceleration of Caste. Berlin, June 1934. In the early stages of the Third Reich, before the world could imagine the horrors to come, a committee of Nazi bureaucrats met to weigh the options for imposing a rigid new hierarchy, one that would isolate Jewish people from Aryans now that the Nazis had taken control. The men summoned in the late spring of 1934 were not, at that time, planning nor in a position to plan extermination. That would come years later, at a chillingly bloodless and cataclysmic meeting in Wannsee, deeper into a world war that had not yet begun. On this day, June 5, 1934, they were there to debate the legal framework for an Aryan nation, to turn ideology into law, and were now anxious to discuss the findings of their research into how other countries protected racial purity from the taint of the disfavored. They sat down for a closed-door session in the Reich capital that day and considered it serious enough to bring a stenographer to record the proceedings and produce a transcript. As they settled into their chairs to hash out what would eventually become the Nuremberg Laws, the first topic on the agenda was the United States and what they could learn from it. The man chairing the meeting, Franz Gertner, the Reich Minister of Justice, introduced a memorandum in the opening minutes, detailing the ministry's investigation into how the United States managed its marginalized groups and guarded its ruling white citizenry. The 17 legal scholars and functionaries went back and forth over American purity laws governing intermarriage and immigration. In debating how to institutionalize racism in the Third Reich, wrote the Yale legal historian James Q. Whitman, they began by asking how the Americans did it. The Nazis needed no outsiders to plant the seeds of hatred within them. But in the early years of the regime, when they still had a stake in the appearance of legitimacy and the hope of foreign investment, they were seeking legal prototypes for the caste system they were building. They were looking to move quickly with their plans for racial separation and purity, and knew that the United States was centuries ahead of them with its anti-miscegenation statutes and race-based immigration bans. For us Germans, it is especially important to know and see how one of the biggest states in the world with Nordic stock already has race legislation, which is quite comparable to that of the German Reich. The German press agency Grossdeutsche Pressedienst wrote, as the Nazis were solidifying their grip on the country. Western Europeans had long been aware of the American paradox of proclaiming liberty for all men while holding subsets of its citizenry in near total subjugation. The French writer Alexis de Tocqueville toured antebellum America in the 1830s and observed that only the surface of American society is covered with a layer of democratic paint. Germany well understood the U.S. fixation on race, purity, and eugenics, the pseudoscience of grading humans by presumed group superiority. Many leading Americans had joined the eugenics movement of the early 20th century, including the inventor Alexander Graham Bell, the auto magnate Henry Ford, and Charles W. Eliot, the president of Harvard University. During the First World War, the German Society for Racial Hygiene applauded the dedication with which Americans sponsor research in the field of racial hygiene and with which they translate theoretical knowledge into practice. The Nazis had been especially taken with the militant race theories of two widely known American eugenicists, Lothrop Stoddard and Madison Grant. Both were men of privilege, born and raised in the North and educated in the Ivy League. Both built their now discredited reputations on hate ideology that devised a crude ranking of European stock, declared Eastern and Southern Europeans inferior to Nordics, and advocated for the exclusion and elimination of races they deemed threats to Nordic racial purity, foremost among them Jews and Negroes. A racial slur that the Nazis adopted in their campaign to dehumanize Jews and other non-Aryans, the word Untermensch, meaning subhuman, came to them from the New England-born eugenicist Lothrop Stoddard. A 1922 book he wrote carried the subtitle The Menace of the Underman, which translated into Untermenschen in the German edition. The Nazis took the word as their own and would most become associated with it. They made Stoddard's book on white supremacy a standard text in the Reich's school curriculum and accorded him a private audience with the purposefully remote Adolf Hitler at the Reich Chancellery in December 1939. Well into World War II, Stoddard sat in on Nazi sterilization trials and commended the Nazis for weeding out the worst strains in the Germanic stock in a scientific and truly humanitarian way. He lamented, though, that, if anything, their judgments were almost too conservative. Madison Grant, a leading eugenicist from New York, whose social circle included Presidents Theodore Roosevelt and Herbert Hoover, converted his zeal for Aryan supremacy into helping enact a series of American immigration and marriage restrictions in the 1920s, as the Nazi Party was forming across the Atlantic. Grant went far beyond Southern segregationists in his contempt for marginalized people. He argued that inferior stocks should be sterilized and quarantined in a rigid system of elimination of those who are weak or unfit, or perhaps worthless race types. Grant published a rabid manifesto for cleansing the gene pool of undesirables. His 1916 book, The Passing of the Great Race, the German edition of which held a special place in the Führer's library. Hitler wrote Grant a personal note of gratitude and said, "The book is my Bible." Hitler had studied America from afar, both envying and admiring it, and attributed its achievements to its Aryan stock. He praised the country's near genocide of Native Americans and the exiling to reservations of those who had survived. He was pleased that the United States had shot down the millions of Redskins to a few hundred thousand. He saw the U.S. Immigration Restriction Act of 1924 as a model for his program of racial purification, historian Jonathan Spiro wrote. The Nazis were impressed by the American custom of lynching its subordinate caste of African Americans, having become aware of the ritual torture and mutilations that typically accompanied them. Hitler especially marveled at the American knack for maintaining an air of robust innocence in the wake of mass death. By the time that Hitler rose to power, the United States was not just a country with racism, Whitman, the Yale legal scholar, wrote. It was the leading racist jurisdiction, so much so that even Nazi Germany looked to America for inspiration. The Nazis recognized the parallels, even if many Americans did not. Thus, on that day in June 1934, as 17 Reich bureaucrats and legal scholars began to deliberate what would become unprecedented legislation for Germany, they were scrutinizing the United States, and they had done their homework. One of the men, Heinrich Krieger, had studied law in the American South as an exchange student at the University of Arkansas. He had written extensively about foreign race regimes, having spent 2 years in South Africa, and was at that very moment completing a book that would be titled Race Law in the United States, to be published in Germany 2 years hence. The Nazi lawyers had researched U.S. jurisprudence well enough to know that from the fugitive slave cases to Plessy v. Ferguson and beyond, the American Supreme Court entertained briefs from southern states whose arguments were indistinguishable from those of the Nazis, Whitman observed. In their search for prototypes, the Nazis had looked into white-dominated countries such as Australia and South Africa, but there were no other models for miscegenation law that the Nazis could find in the world, Whitman wrote. Their overwhelming interest was in the classic example, the United States of America. These 17 men were convening at a time of intrigue and upheaval in a country descending into dictatorship. The Nazis were in the final throes of consolidating their power after their takeover the year before. Hitler had been sworn in as chancellor, but was not yet the Führer. That would not happen until later that summer, in August 1934, when the death of Germany's ailing president, Paul von Hindenburg, the last holdover of the Weimar regime, cleared the way for Hitler to seize total control. Hitler had made it to the chancellery in a brokered deal that conservative elites agreed to only because they were convinced they could hold him in check and make use of him for their own political aims. They underestimated his cunning and overestimated his base of support, which had been the very reason they'd felt they needed him in the first place. At the height of their power at the polls, the Nazis never pulled the majority they coveted and drew only 38% of the vote in the country's last free and fair elections at the onset of their 12-year reign. The old guard did not foresee, or chose not to see, that his actual mission was to exploit the methods of democracy to destroy democracy. By the time they recognized their fatal miscalculation, it was too late. Hitler had risen as an outside agitator, a cult figure enamored of pageantry and rallies with parades of people carrying torches that an observer said looked like rivers of fire. Hitler saw himself as the voice of the folk, of their grievances and fears, especially those in the rural districts, as a God-chosen savior running on instinct. He had never held elected office before. As soon as he was sworn in as chancellor, the Nazis unfurled their swastikas, a Sanskrit symbol linking them to their Aryan roots, and began to close in on the Jews. They stoked ancient resentments that dated back to the Middle Ages, but that rose again when the Jews were made the scapegoats for Germany's loss and humiliation at the end of World War I. Seen as dominant in banking and finance, Jews were blamed for the insufficient financial support of the war effort, although historians now widely acknowledge that Germany lost on the battlefield and not solely for lack of funds. Still, Nazi propaganda worked to turn Germans against Jewish citizens. Nazi thugs taunted and beat up Jews in the streets and any Aryans who were found to be in relationships with them. The regime began restricting Jews from working in government or in high-status professions like medicine or the law, fields that incited jealousy among ordinary Germans who could not afford the expensive cars and villas on the lake that many successful Jews had acquired. This was the middle of the Great Depression, and more than a third of Germans were out of work in 1933, the year the Nazis came to power. The Jews' prestige and wealth were seen as above the station of a group that Nazis decreed were beneath the Aryans. Mindful of appearances beyond their borders, for the time being at least, the Nazis wondered how the United States had managed to turn its racial hierarchy into rigid law, yet retain such a sterling reputation on the world stage. They noticed that in the United States, when it came to these racial prohibitions, public opinion accepted them as natural, wrote the historian Claudia Kunz. A young Nazi intellectual named Herbert Kier was tasked with compiling a table of U.S. race laws and was confounded by the lengths to which America went to segregate its population. He made note that, by law in most southern states, white children and colored children are sent to different schools, and that most states further demand that race be given in birth certificates, licenses, and death certificates. He discovered that many American states even go so far as to require by statute segregated facilities for coloreds and whites in waiting rooms, train cars, sleeping cars, streetcars, buses, steamboats, and even in prisons and jails. In Arkansas, he noted, the tax rolls were segregated. He later remarked that, given the fundamental proposition of the equality of everything that bears a human countenance, it is all the more astonishing how extensive race legislation is in the USA. Kier was just one of several Nazi researchers who thought American law went overboard, Whitman wrote. With the results of their research laid out before them, the men at the June meeting began debating two main pathways to their version of a caste system. First, creating a legal definition for the categories of Jews and Aryans, and second, prohibiting intermarriage between the two. Germany had looked at America's miscegenation laws decades before and tested its own intermarriage ban at the turn of the 20th century when it forbade its settlers to mix with indigenous people in its colonies in Southwest Africa. In so doing, Germany went further than most colonial powers, but it did not come close to the American model. Now Nazi extremists pushed for ways to prevent any further penetration of Jewish blood into the body of the German Volk. As the debate got underway, Krieger, the former University of Arkansas law student, reported that Americans had gone so far as to make interracial marriage a crime punishable by as much as 10 years imprisonment in many jurisdictions. He pointed out that the United States had divided its population in two with artificial line drawing between white and colored people. He and other Nazis showed a fascination with the American habit of assigning humans to categories by fractions of perceived ancestry. There is a growing tendency in judicial practice, Krieger said, to assign a person to a group of coloreds whenever there is even a trace of visible Negro physical features. The men who gathered for that meeting did not agree on how much to draw from American jurisprudence. The moderates at the table, among them the chair himself, Franz Gertner, argued for less onerous methods than the Americans were using. He suggested that education and enlightenment about the perils of race mixing might be enough to discourage Aryans from intermarrying with others. At one point, he sought to downplay the U.S. prototype because he had a hard time believing that Americans actually enforced the laws the Nazis had uncovered. Gertner simply refused to concede that the Americans actually went so far as to prosecute miscegenists, Whitman wrote. One of the hardliners at the table, the Nazi radical Roland Freisler, was impatient with the pace of the proceedings. He had joined the Nazi Party back in the 1920s and was pushing for a law to punish Jews and Aryans for racial treason if they intermarried. Time and again, he and the other extremists in the room brought the discussion back to the American statutes, explained and defended them, and tried to convince the skeptics. "How have they gone about doing this?" Freisler asked at one point, breaking down his research into the United States and its laws of human classification. The Americans, he explained, used a range of motley parameters to separate white people from everyone else. One state, he said, classified as non-white any and all persons from Africa, Korea, or Malaysia. In another example, he said, Nevada speaks of Ethiopians or of the black race, Malaysians or of the brown race, Mongols or of the yellow race. Freisler argued that the overlapping contradictions could work to their advantage. The tangle of American definitions lent a measure of latitude and a useful inconsistency to the task of human division. The Americans had come up with a definition of race apart from logic or science, an approach that Freisler called the political construction of race. What the Nazis could not understand, however, was why in America, the Jews, who are also of interest to us, are not reckoned among the coloreds, when it was so obvious to the Nazis that Jews were a separate race, and when America had already shown some aversion by imposing quotas on Jewish immigration. Aside from what to the Nazis was a single vexing omission, this jurisprudence would suit us perfectly, said Freisler, who, unbeknownst to those at the table, would one day be in a position to make heartless use of it in his career as the hanging judge of the Reich. I am of the opinion that we need to proceed with the same primitivity that is used by these American states, he said. Such a procedure would be crude, but it would suffice. The doubters continued to question the American statutes. They went back and forth on exactly how a marriage ban would work, parsed the proposed definition of Jew and Aryan, tried to make sense of the American fraction system. Moderates were disturbed by the idea that people who were half-Jewish and half-Aryan would be cut off from their Aryan side and deprived of caste privileges they would otherwise be accorded. Rather than defining such people as half-Jewish, the skeptics wondered, would they not also be half-Aryan? But one hardliner, Achim Gerke, referred back to the prototype they had been studying. He proposed a definition of 1/16th Jewish for classification of Jews, Kunz wrote, because he did not wish to be less rigorous than the Americans. The men debated for 10 hours that day and ended without agreement. We have been talking past one another, Freisler, frustrated by the lack of progress, said toward the end. The moderates had managed, for now, to contain the radicals who had pushed for the American prototype. But 15 months later, the radicals would prevail. In September 1935, Hitler summoned the Reichstag to the annual Nazi rally in Nuremberg to announce new legislation that had been incubating since the Nazi takeover. By then, Hitler had either imprisoned or killed many of his political opponents, including the murders of 12 members of the Reichstag and of his longtime friend Ernst Röhm, the head of a Nazi paramilitary unit, the SA. All of this rendered the Reichstag a puppet arm of the government, having been intimidated into submission. At that very moment, the Nazis were building concentration camps all over the country. One was soon to open in Sachsenhausen, north of the Reich capital, and would become one of their showcases. The plan was to announce the legislation, ultimately known as the Blood Laws, on the final day of the rally. The night before, Hitler directed a small group of deputies to draft a version for him to deliver to the Reichstag to rubber stamp. The Nazi researchers had come across a provision in some of the U.S. miscegenation laws that could help them define whether a person who was half-Jewish should count as a Jew or an Aryan. It turned out that Texas and North Carolina had an association clause in their marriage bans that helped those states decide if an ambiguous person was black or white, privileged or disfavored. Such a person would be counted in the disfavored group if they'd been married to or had been known to associate with people in the disfavored group, thus defying caste purity. This was what Hitler announced that September and expanded in the months to come. The law for the protection of German blood and German honor defined a Jew as a person with three Jewish grandparents. It also counted as Jewish anyone descended from two Jewish grandparents who practiced Judaism or was accepted into the Jewish community or was married to a Jew, in line with the Americans Association Clause. Secondly, the law banned marriage and intercourse outside of marriage between Jews and Germans, and it forbade German women under 45 to work in a Jewish household. Thus began a campaign of ever-tightening restrictions. Jews were henceforth stripped of citizenship, prohibited from displaying the German flag, denied passports. With that announcement, Germany became a full-fledged racist regime, the historian George M. Fredrickson wrote. American laws were the main foreign precedents for such legislation. But given the Nazis' own fixation on race, the American prototype had its limits. The scholars who see parallels between the American and Nazi racial classification schemes are, to that extent, wrong, Whitman said, but only because they understate the relative severity of American law. As cataclysmic as the Nuremberg laws were, the Nazis had not gone as far with the legislation as their research into America had taken them. What did not gain traction on the day of the closed-door session or in the final version of the Nuremberg laws was one aspect of the American system. While the Nazis praised the American commitment to legislating racial purity, they could not abide the unforgiving hardness under which an American man or woman who has even a drop of Negro blood in their veins counted as blacks, Whitman wrote. The one-drop rule was too harsh for the Nazis. Chapter 9. The Evil of Silence. The ash rose from the crematorium into the air, carried by karma and breeze, and settled onto the front steps and geranium beds of the townspeople living outside the gates of death at Sachsenhausen, north of Berlin. The ash coated the swing sets and paddling pools in the backyards of the townspeople. There was no denying the slaughter and torment on the other side of the barbed wire. The fruit of evil fell upon villagers like snow dust. They were covered in evil, and some were good parents and capable spouses, and yet they did nothing to stop the evil, which had now grown too big for one person to stop, and thus no one person was complicit, and yet everyone was complicit. It had grown bigger than them because they had allowed it to grow bigger than them, and now it was raining down onto their gingerbread cottages and their lives of pristine conformity. The dissident theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer was one of the millions who suffered and perished behind the electrified walls of a Nazi concentration camp, tortured and kept in solitary confinement. Could the townspeople hear the prayers of the innocents? Silence in the face of evil is itself evil, Bonhoeffer once said of bystanders. God will not hold us guiltless. Not to speak is to speak. Not to act is to act. The villagers were not all Nazis. In fact, many Germans were not Nazis. But they followed the Nazi leaders on the radio, waited to hear the latest from Hitler and Goebbels, the Nazis having seized the advantage of this new technology, the chance to reach Germans live and direct in their homes, anytime they chose. An intravenous drip to the mind. The people had ingested the lies of an inherent Untermenschen, that these prisoners, Jews, Sinti, homosexuals, opponents of the Reich, were not humans like themselves. And thus the townspeople swept the ash from their steps and carried on with their days. Mothers pulled their children inside when the wind kicked up, hurried them along to keep them from being covered in the ash of fellow human beings. In the middle of Main Street, in a southern American town, there stood a majestic old tree, an elm or an oak or a sycamore, that had been planted before modern roads were paved. It held a sacred place in the hearts of the townspeople, though it was an altogether inconvenient location for a shade tree. It blocked traffic, coming and going, and motorists were forced to curve around it to get through town. It was the potential cause of many accidents, given that motorists could not always see past it or know for sure who had the right of way. And yet it could not be cut down. It was the local lynching tree, and it was performing its duty to perpetually and eternally remind the black townspeople of who among them had last been hanged from its limbs and who could be next. The tree was awaiting its appointed hour, and the white townspeople were willing to risk inconvenience, injury, and death, even to themselves, to keep the tree and the subordinate caste in their places. The tree bore silent witness to black citizens of their eternal lot, and in so doing, it whispered reassurances to the dominant caste of theirs. The townspeople of the East Texas village of Leesburg hammered a buggy axle into the ground to serve as a stake. Then they chained 19-year-old Wiley McNeely to it. They collected the kindling they would use for the fire at the base of his feet, despite his protestations of innocence in connection to the white girl they said he had assaulted. 500 people gathered that fall in 1921 to see Wiley McNeely burn to death in front of them. But first, the leaders of the lynching had to settle a matter of importance. The leaders drew lots to see who would get which piece of McNeely's body after they had burned him alive, figure out the body parts which they regarded as the choicest souvenir. This they did in front of the young man facing his final seconds on this earth, there chained up and left to hear of the disposition of his fingers and ears to the men who had kidnapped him outside of the law. The leaders debated this in front of the 500 people who had come to watch him die and who were impatient for the festivities to begin. After the men had decided and after all was settled, they lit the match. The little girls appear to be in grade school, in light cotton dresses with a sailor's collar, and their hair cut in precise page boys just below their ears. In the picture, the two younger girls seem to be fidgeting in shadow, close to the women in the group, who were perhaps their mothers or aunts. The girl you notice first, though, looks to be about 10 years old, positioned at the front of the group of grown-ups and children, her eyes alert and riveted. A man is at her side, crisp in his tailored white pants, white shirt, and white Panama hat, as if headed to cocktail hour at a boating party, his arms folded, face at rest, unperturbed, vaguely bored. It is July 19th, 1935. They're all standing at the base of a tree in the pine woods of Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Above them hangs the limp body of Reuben Stacy, his overalls torn and bloodied, riddled with bullets, his hands cuffed in front of him, head snapped from the lynching rope, killed for frightening a white woman. The girl in the front is looking up at the dead black man with wonderment rather than horror, a smile of excitement on her face, as if show ponies had just galloped past her at the circus. The fascination on her young face, set against the gruesome nature of the gathering, was captured by a photographer and is among the most widely circulated of all lynching photographs of 20th century America. Lynchings were part carnival, part torture chamber, and attracted thousands of onlookers who collectively became accomplices to public sadism. Photographers were tipped off in advance and installed portable printing presses at the lynching sites to sell to lynchers and onlookers like photographers at a prom. They made postcards out of the gelatin prints for people to send to their loved ones. People mailed postcards of the severed, half-burned head of Will James atop a pole in Cairo, Illinois, in 1907. They sent postcards of burned torsos that looked like the petrified victims of Vesuvius. Only these horrors had come at the hands of human beings in modern times. Some people framed the lynching photographs with locks of the victim's hair under glass if they had been able to secure any. One spectator wrote on the back of his postcard from Waco, Texas in 1916, "This is the barbecue we had last night. My picture is to the left with the cross over it. Your son, Joe." This was singularly American. Even the Nazis did not stoop to selling souvenirs of Auschwitz, wrote Time magazine many years later. Lynching postcards were so common a form of communication in turn of the 20th century America that lynching scenes became a burgeoning subdepartment of the postcard industry. By 1908, the trade had grown so large, and the practice of sending postcards featuring the victims of mob murderers had become so repugnant that the U.S. Postmaster General banned the cards from the mails. But the new edict did not stop Americans from sharing their lynching exploits. From then on, they merely put the postcards in an envelope. In downtown Omaha, they started a bonfire and readied it for Will Brown. The newspapers had advertised the lynching in advance, and as many as 15,000 people gathered on the courthouse square that day in September 1919. So many people that one cannot make out the faces in the human sea in a wide shot taken from above. These thousands of dots on a gelatin print, fathers, grandfathers, uncles, nephews, brothers, teenagers, were of one mind, had fused into an organism unto itself, intent on a single mission, not only to kill, but to humiliate, torture, and incinerate another human being, and together, to breathe in the smoke of burning flesh. 2 days before, a white woman and her boyfriend had said that a black man had molested her when the couple were out on the town. No one alive knows what happened for sure, and there were questions even then. Resentment had been building against the influx of black Southerners arriving north during the Great Migration, and Will Brown, a packing house worker, was the man the sheriffs arrested. There was no investigation, no due process. That day, the mob looted guns from local pawn shops and general stores, and fired on the courthouse where Brown had been detained. Before they could even get to him, the mob killed two of their own, a bystander and a fellow rioter, with their ragged gunshots. They set the courthouse on fire to force the sheriff to hand Brown over to them. They cut the water hoses to keep the firefighters from putting out the blaze. And when the mayor tried to appeal to the mob, the leaders put a rope around his neck and inflicted injuries that put him in the hospital. The leaders of the mob pulled Brown from the rooftop of the courthouse, where the courthouse workers had escaped from the fire and where the prisoners had been taken. Then the people in the mob began the task for which they had gathered. First, they stripped Will Brown, and those up front fought each other to beat him. They hoisted him, half-conscious, onto a lamppost outside the courthouse. Then they fired bullets into his dangling body, cheering as they fired. And it was from these gunshots that the coroner said Brown died. They burned his body in the bonfire they had made on the courthouse square. Then they tied the body to a police car and dragged the corpse through the streets of Omaha. They cut the pieces of rope they had used to hoist him, and these they sold as keepsakes for people's display cabinets and fireplace mantels. The photographers on the scene captured the lynching from different angles and produced postcards of the men in business suits and teenagers in newsboy hats posing as if at a wedding reception, crowding into the frame above the charred torso, sparks of fire amid the ash, an image they would send to cousins and in-laws and former neighbors around the country. A 14-year-old boy was helping his father at his printing plant across the street from the courthouse in the middle of the riot. The boy's name was Henry Fonda, and he would leave Omaha when he grew up and make a name for himself as a leading man in Hollywood. That evening in 1919, against the hollers of the mob and the man hanging from a lamppost and the cinders of the bonfire, Fonda and his father locked the plant and drove home in silence. "It was the most horrendous sight I've ever seen," he would say years later when he was an old man. The decades had not swept the ash from his memory. It was perhaps no coincidence that he would appear in many movies in which he was the moral voice calling for a life to be spared. In the 1943 film The Oxbow Incident, about vigilante violence, it is Fonda's character who warns a bloodlusting mob, "Man just naturally can't take the law into his own hands and hang people without hurting everybody in the world."
Context of white supremacy. Man, we have covered so much material here at the COWS and with reading material specifically about white supremacy racism that I said, wow, I think this, I don't even remember how many times, but we have covered Henry Fonda a few times in this incident with the lynching. I had to go back to make sure I was not lying. Let's see. Is this it? Oh, let's see. Trapped in the Burning Built. So I'm reading from Cameron McWhorter. This is a white man, Red Summer. He was a guest on the program in 2011. He's a journalist at the Wall Street Journal. So in his book, Red Summer, he writes, "Trapped in the burning building, some prisoners prayed, others cursed, some demanded that Brown be turned over. Sheriff Clark reported that white deputies stopped black prisoners from throwing Brown off the roof to the waiting crowd. About 11 p.m., 9 hours after the mob first formed, it achieved its objective. As rioters made their way onto the smoky upper floors, somebody handed the nigger to us, one told a reporter. We tied a rope around his neck and dragged him to the south side of the building. Investigators later believed Clark handed him over, though he denied it. Before they brought him to the mob, rioters beat him senseless and tore off his clothes. Here he is. Rioters cheered as they dragged him outside. 14-year-old Henry Fonda saw the lynching from the second floor of his father's printing shop across from the courthouse. His father felt it was important for his son to witness the savagery. Fonda recalled looking down on the mob, choking the courthouse square, cursing, waving guns and clubs. Fonda saw Brown dragged from the jail by a group of armed men. A great huzzah went up when they saw the poor fellow. He recalled they took him, strung him up to the end of a lamppost, and while his feet were still dancing in the air, they riddled his body with bullets. It was the most horrendous sight. Then they cut down the body, tied it to an auto, and dragged it through the streets of Omaha. Fonda's father did not say a word as they drove home. My hands were wet, and there were tears in my eyes. Fonda wrote later in his autobiography, all I could think of was that young black man dangling at the end of the lamppost, the shots, and the revulsion I felt. Omaha's Black Weekly, The Monitor, reported mothers with babes in arms pushed forward to see the body. A few women fainted, but more shouted with glee. Let me read that one again, because it's the man. We talk about racism, white supremacy, and patriarchy, and oh, the white woman is an ally. We had to get so many mentions of Heather Heyer. Let me read that one again. Omaha's Black Weekly, The Monitor, reported mothers with babes in arms pushed forward to see the body. A few women fainted, but more shouted with glee. The corpse was driven several blocks away, then soaked in gasoline, piled with debris, and set aflame. A photographer recorded the gruesome event in one photo. Brown's body roasted in flames, his melted, empty skull facing the dark sky. The charred torso, the limbs burned away, lay on burning planks. Satisfied rioters, wow, white people refer to as rioters, amazing. Satisfied rioters stood around the dead man and mugged for the camera. A young boy smiled over the shoulder to stare down at the remains. A workman with a derby leaned smiling toward the fire. After the fire died down, people kicked the torso down the street. Rioters looted more hardware stores for weapons and ammunition. They went to the city jail to look for black prisoners, but the police captain on duty had already let them all go. He let a committee of rioters inspect the jail. They eventually left. I will stop there just because, as I said, we've covered so much material. We didn't read that book in the book club, although I read it personally, and Cameron McWhorter, the author, was a guest on the program in 2011. You have to go back to listen to that. That was interesting. The other tidbit, when she was talking about all of these, the lynching tree in the town, it reminded me of we had another white author on the program, Monty Akers, was a guest, same year, 2011. I guess that was a good one. Flames After Midnight, Murder, Vengeance, and the Desolation of a Texas Community. She talked about Waco. This is not Waco. But they talked about, I'll just read. So there's a lynching, and they end up killing a black person and killing a whole lot of black people in this area of Texas, 1922. So at the end of the book, they write, the road along which, the plow around which Snap Curry, John Cornish, and Mose Jones were burned, all black people victims of racism, remained in the vacant lot in Kirvin, Texas for 20 years. The implement was a symbol. Some of the remaining whites of Kirvin believed to remind blacks to stay in their place. During a scrap drive, early in World War II, a teenage Harry Hughes and his father saw the plow but did not know its significance. They loaded it in a pickup, hauled it to Corsicana, and delivered it to the scrap iron dealer. When they returned, they were informed of the significance of their act. Several natives were very upset, but nothing could be done. This was the first Harry had heard of the burnings, but he learned all he could about the incident thereafter. He worked most of his adult life for the Dow Chemical Company and returned to Kirvin after retiring. He lives there today. The site of the burnings was never built on and was partially covered with scrub trees and weeds for many years. on the part not overgrown, a volleyball net was erected. The teenagers and children who play there are happily oblivious to the dark history lurking nearby. Just, they were upset. Apparently these outsiders didn't know the history, but there's tons and tons of those incidents, lynchings of black people, and often memorialized. We talked about that with Jacqueline Battalore in 2010, making memorials of incidents of white terrorism. Anyway, Isabel Wilkerson's case, lots of interest, lots of people emailed. We'll see if folks who dialed in have thoughts, observations, questions to share. The number is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see, folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, excuse me, commentary to share, let's see, line should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida, yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everybody on the line. Interesting first half. Because I study war, and for the most part is World War II, and basically in the first half it was a lot of information about the pre part of World War II in the 1930s, the Nazi Party. I was just thinking about recent news in this part of the world about saying on how bad things can go. But apparently that is not all true, because back in the 1930s, Germany was actually studying their terrorism and white supremacy from white people in this part of the world. I mean, almost tracing the science page for page. And that's basically what was being talked about in the first half, with the and also with the concentration camps. Situations. It reminds me from my own studies that white people who were right next to these camps, and I think what she was describing was the residual of bodies being burnt. The different ashes and whatnot actually would fly all over the towns and the areas that are within very close distance to these camps. But yet, as I recall through study, is that when other white people, I put it this way, the winning party of white people came upon them, they were all in denial and acting as though they didn't know that these events was going on at the time over in Germany. I can recall Dr. Welsing, who went to study in Germany, state that white people who will call themselves Germans were still addressing each other by saying, "Hi, Hitler." And that was in the 50s. Also, I was just thinking about the part with Henry Fonda, Hall of Fame actor. I actually liked the movies, some of the movies that he played in. I have one copied right now that came on a couple of days ago. But nevertheless, speaking about Omaha, Nebraska, it doesn't get as much credit as it deserves for a hotbed for racism, white supremacy. Malcolm X was born there. Recently deceased Hall of Famer Gale Sayers grew up there. But in those Midwest areas, there was a lot of terrorism of that magnitude going on during that time, as opposed to the quote unquote traditional South. It was a lot of that going on in the Midwest, you know, in that Nebraska, you know, type of areas, those areas, the whole idea of they made huge hoot nanny parties out of the advent of chaining to trees and poles and roasting non-white black people and taking body parts and collecting souvenirs, that sort of thing, into the tens of thousands of people. That was a standard practice during that time, and it's worthy of one's research to be able to have a understanding of the background of racism, white supremacy. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged. Much obliged, retired firefighter. Other folks who dialed in, if you have observations, comments on the text, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Silent Warrior joining us live. It is our obligatory timestamp, 3:19 a.m. Friday morning, Norway time. Good to hear from you, sir.
Thank you. I liked this section of the book because she's mainly sharing facts about information about other parts of the world, and I especially like the part that she said about Nazi Germany. But I have some comments on the text. She talked about India and Nazi Germany, that both adopted social hierarchies and those deemed lowest in the country would serve those deemed high. I would have thought that she had put more emphasis that India had this way before the British colonized them. I thought that was not... It would have been useful to have mentioned that. She uses this term in the text, immigrants from outside of Europe. I thought that's interesting, and it sounded as a code word for non-whites, because immigrants from outside Europe have a greater chance of being non-white. So, as you know, she also talked about such persons have a tendency to be darker than upper caste people. Finally, she's mentioning skin color. I would have liked her to speak even more about the work of these Indians from the so-called lower class who did more resistance work, Ambedkar and Pulle. I thought that was, I hope that she speaks some more about their work. And I thought it was quite corny the way she ended that chapter by saying how the Dalit hosts joined the Visiting Americans by singing We Shall Overcome. I thought, come on. You must have better anecdotes than that. Like, we can't escape, we overcome even in India. But it, at the same time, it tells you how strong that story of, you know, that phrase has struck, you know, how much it has been promoted by the system across the world. She talks about racial separation and purity, and the Nazis were really talking about white purity. And the same was for the Americans. So that's two out of the three systems that you're studying, but you don't mention, you don't use that word. Okay. I'm glad to see the references to Stoddard and Grant. That means my time in the Kaus archives is well spent. However, I thought it would have been really interesting if she had been managed to, I mean, to say that how these guys were being promoted even by the president in their time. But I thought that was good information that she was sharing about his work. And this statement about that, Hitler saying that he marveled at American knack for maintaining an air of robust innocence in the wake of mass death. That Hitler is particularly marveled at the American knack for doing this is, I thought that was a very, very strong statement, because that's what they do now. That's what they do now. Say, like, racism doesn't exist. But what I thought was interesting was this percentage that the Nazis never pulled a majority, but they drew only 38% of the vote in the country's last free and fair election. That's interesting to me, because I read an article in Politico recently where that described, that was attempting to describe Trump's support. It's written by Matthew C. McWilliams, and he describes Americans as authoritarians, and that there's a percentage of Americans that are naturally willing to have an authoritarian leader, and Trump is such a person, and the percentage he gives is 40%. And that percentage is all that's needed in order for someone like Trump to be supported and to win. So when I see the same percentage, I said 38%. The Nazis get 38%, needed 30%, and they were able to come to power, and then Americans and Trump had 40% of this population that thinks of themselves as an authoritarian. They are able to come to power. I thought that was really strange, really uncanny comparison. And the parallels with Trump's, with Trump supporters having tiki torches, and Hitler's parades of people carrying torches that look like rivers of fire. I thought that was, that was a good comparison there, Wilkerson. That was a very good comparison. I noticed there was one Welted moment where she said how Nazi extremists pushed for ways to prevent any further penetration of Jewish blood into the body of the German Volk. That's a Welted moment for me. And that the Germans are so shocked about America. I thought that was, this part of the book was pretty good, and it's of course because she's referring to a very good study of Nazi Germany, studying America before they brought in their rules, where Germans are, that she's saying that Germans are shocked at how, I thought that was really good, how she's saying how the Germans are studying America because that is the standard of how to maintain racial purity at that time. I'm glad, I think that was good that you put it in. Let's see. But when she says that the one, that Whitman wrote that the one drop rule was too harsh for the Nazis, I wish that she answered the question why, or Whitman would have answered the question why. Like, why did they think it was too harsh? And I suspect it's because the Germans didn't have a large enough percentage of non-white people in Germany at the time. And if they did, probably they would have come up with that rule on their own. That's my thinking. Yeah, but I actually just woke up, so I don't know exactly where you ended in the text. So I'll just end there and continue my comments when I after the next segment. Thank you for the time.
Much obliged, Silent Warrior. If we have other folks who have comments, questions, observations to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. It's different between blacks and what she claims to be our Indian equivalent. I forget the name she used. She claimed that we both have roles, similar roles in the society. But we don't live in a society with a hereditary caste system like India. We come from a society where you are supposed to have the opportunity to be whatever you want. Almost every politician gives their heartfelt stories about being born poor or and making it out of that, or coming from parents or grandparents who, had nothing and building up something, and we haven't been given that opportunity, and that's the difference. That doesn't change anything in their structure. Whereas you have a group of people constantly keeping another group of people from reaching a certain point. It's totally different. That comes from power, it's no power force or no power system keeping the caste in India from breaking. They just decided to do this based off of their belief system. Whereas here you have people forcing, constantly, rigorously redlining and coming up with another way and another way to keep people from coming up and reaching where they are, even though we have the opportunity to. It's just they take that away from us, and that's not the same. Karma, it sounds a lot like the Christian virtues, like even the virtue of justice, you get rewarded for good deeds and death in Christianity. You go to heaven as opposed to hell, and it seems like they go with the belief that you get rewarded in the next life. It's just a similar virtue system. The more degrees black people seem to get, the more they like to talk about Hitler and the poor Jews. And it's always these innocent Jews who were killed by these jealous Nazis, Mind you, most of the history written about the Nazi mistreatment of the Jews, and that is taught and accepted as factual, has been written and published by the Jews. So, you don't get any other opposing view on that. It's very difficult. Leaving out the Jews what the Jews did to cause Germans to dislike them, leaving out the transfer agreement and other things that caused that whole thing to go the way it did. And they also make the Jews into a race, which is wrong. They are white people who practice a certain faith. I think in this book she's attempting to paint the picture that makes a comparison between Hitler and Trump. The problem is that Nazi means national socialism. Nazism minus fascism is simply democratic socialism, and that's certainly not the position Trump has. That's the Democrats' position. And the Jews were forced to work and get gassed to death in camps for much less than a few generations. You know, that was a few years compared to what we had to endure. Like, it's no comparison. I don't think she believes this stuff that she put here. I think it's propaganda, similar to the propaganda that her former employer keeps printing every day. I think she only put this book out to keep up the anti-Trump narrative. And I believe she probably did some research on Cast and threw it to the side, and when given the opportunity to come out with something, she just threw it together real quick to put out something. But it seems like the ongoing thing I'm getting from this book is an anti-Trump thing. It's not being genuine. Like, if you were really going to tell us about Cast and what's going on and how you see this as it pertains to our situation here in America, then just keep it there. You know, you don't have to have an agenda. It seems like this is an agenda. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas, in New York. Let's see. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, good evening. I think she mentioned a word like a couple times, Aryans. I think she mentioned Aryans when she was speaking about the Indian caste system and when she was speaking about Germany. And I don't think she explained who the Aryans were or what racial classifications the Aryans are. What else? And the Jews. I always thought that Hitler was killing people because they were not white. So I assumed that the Jews were assumed to be not white and I guess not pure. And she also made a comment in the book where she said that the American caste system is bipolar, saying that it's not hierarchical. She said that white immigrants come to the U.S. and they're in like a blood position. But I disagree with that notion because I'm saying that is, excuse me, an hierarchical system because the immigrants, the white immigrants that come to America, they're not black. They're not white, but they're also not black. So that is a hierarchical system. And I think, yeah, that's all I have for right now. Thanks, let me share.
Yes, ma'am. Much obliged. Are there other folks that we have missed totally? You have commentary? Hand up. Okay, I guess, did we get everybody, at least for the time being? All righty. Wow. There are a lot of folks who wrote in. I'll see if I can get to all of the written commentary. So, all right, one of our investors wrote in, still trying to catch up from last week. Chapter 4, a long-running play in the emergence of caste in America. Number 2, Americans are loath to talk about the enslavement, in part because of what little we know about it goes against our perception of our country as a just an enlightened nation, a beacon of democracy for the world. Slavery is commonly dismissed as a sad, dark chapter in the country's history. I think when the author says Americans, she actually means white people. Number three, it is a measure of how long enslavement lasted in the United States that the year 2022 marks the first year that the United States will have been an independent nation for as long as slavery lasted on its soil. I thought this was an interesting observation. Number four, author's exchange with the Nigerian playwright. Africans are not black. They are Igbo. They don't become black until they go to America or come to the UK. I detected an element of anti-blackness by the Nigerian playwright. She may be implying a sense of superiority by those born on the continent over those blacks born in the U.S. or the U.K., like the author who was born in Washington, D.C. I could be wrong about this. Same caller continues. Chapter 5, The Container We Have Built For You. Number 1, the family welcomed her and got a kick out of her name and how her family had stuck it to those bigots down south. There was a time, the matriarch said, in warning and regret, when I could have made you stay. She adjusted herself, her voice trailing off at her impotence. The author has a gift for finding and writing compelling stories about black people. I thought the story of Miss Hale contained elements of black self-respect and lessons regarding the dedication of racist man, racist woman, and racist child. There was also an example of racial focal pointing. The final statement reinforced to me that even though the suspected racist can treat you nice, it doesn't mean they are not racist. Number two, each of us is in a container of some kind. The label signals to the world what is presumed to be inside and what is to be done with it. The label tells you which shelf your container supposedly belongs on. In a cased system, the label is frequently out of sync with the contents, mistakenly put on the wrong shelf, and this hurts people and institutions in ways that we may not always know. Another unfortunate metaphor by the author. I think in the global system of racism, white supremacy, the label is your race, and it does not matter what is inside. That is the point. The author again distances white people from their crimes by inferring that both suspected racists and their non-white victims are harmed. In addition, she again implies that racists are unaware of the harm that they do. Number three, the problem could have happened any place because the problem is, in fact, at the root. I think it would have been valuable for the author to name the company in which the act of racism took place. This is about the incident when she went to do the interview, and the wife was like, I'm here for an interview for the Times. Get out of the way. I don't have time to talk to you. And she's like, I work for the Times. All that. That type of information could be valuable to non-white victims. I am suspicious regarding the truth behind her stated reason for not naming the person or the institution. I suspect she did not name them in order to prevent trouble for herself, which I, of course, understand, or possibly at the suggestion, insistence of her editors or legal team, which vets such work. This is published by Random House, which is a pretty major corporation. Stop there. We'll continue. He has more notes as well, as do some of our other folks who wrote in. I'll get in some of my notes also. Fascinating, this book. I guess since it's pretty new, stimulated a lot of thoughts from listeners, which is grand. That's supposed to be the case with reading, they say. I will point out, I said last week about the footnotes. I went back and looked at The Warmth of Other Suns, written by the same author and in my top 10. That book has the footnotes right within the body of the text, and I have the same version of both books published by the same. Both of them are Random House publications. The footnotes being in the body of that text, and there are so many more footnotes with that text, that is a longer book. The footnotes here, they're not within the body of the text. There are notes in the back of the book of the version that I have, but they are short. Like, wow, if somebody, I mean, just on that alone, like she said, she spent 15 years writing The Warmth of Other Suns. She did not disclose how long she's been working on this book. If somebody wanted to make an argument about this is kind of put together quickly or, you know, that sort of thing. That's the type of thing that I pay attention to. This does not seem to be as well researched as The Warmth of Other Suns. Doesn't have to be, just noting a difference, a major difference. And for me, books that do not have the footnotes in them, so you can immediately go to the references, that is not an improvement. That's it. So we are 7 chapters into this book, and just for scale, there are 31 chapters in the book. So, you know, we're not even 30% of the way into the text. And we've already had 2 Heather Hare references. That's the white woman suspected racist who was killed in 2015 in Charlottesville. I pointed out last week we didn't hear the Charleston church shooting in 2015, although that does get mentioned later on in the book. But Heather Hare has already been mentioned twice. Like, wow. I've said that consistently, how white people, even in death, can come to dominate when we're talking about racism, white supremacy, the well-meaning white person, the white sacrifice, John Brown, Heather Hare, Jane Elliott. And why I think that's especially significant, books like this, some people, this is how they're coming to think about racism seriously. This is a book that's being heavily promoted, Democracy Now!, New York Times, all the mainstream outlets. She's done tons of interviews, not on this platform, whites only. But all of everything that's happening right now, a lot of non-white people, I want to understand what's happening with Breonna Taylor. Why does this keep happening? They didn't even indict those officers. Maybe CASED will help me understand. I don't think so. Let's see. Both adopted social hierarchies and abide great chasms between the highest and the lowest in their respective lands. That's what I mean about this is not an accurate text. When I see non-white people, really anybody, when they're writing and they're using language like segregation, integration, separation, great chasms, we read The Warmth of Other Suns. Remember Ida Mae Gladney? She moved from Mississippi to Chicago. She had that incident. I made a sound clip. She was working at a house for her friend. White man tried to rape her. Come get in bed with me, young gal. She talked about that, talked about how widespread that was. That's not separation. That's not integration. That's we'll rape you whenever we want. And we talked about that many times. That's at the dark end of the street. Danielle McGuire, guest on the program, 2011, suspected racist. Many, many illustrations. We talked about that over and over and over again. White people raping non-white people, males and females. That's in Delectable Negro, The Man Not. We talked about that repeatedly. It's not separation. It's domination. I can't mistreat you if I'm separate from you. That's what I mean about we have to be accurate about what we're talking about. Power and domination is totally different from separate. Even when we say separate, how can you have cases like Strom Thurmond, white senator? How can that be standard? That's not what they call an aberration. It's lots of Strom Thurmonds. The Negro, the Negro, the Negro, and then the same thing. Oh, yeah, and that child rapist. Oh, little 14-year-old Negro gal. Come here. Let me. That's not segregation. That's not stay away from the Negro. That's I like to rape, dominate, and terrorize the Negro. You can't even do the Negro barbecues if you're separate. Let's see. Separate. She keeps both countries kept their dominant caste separate, apart and above those deemed lower. That is not true. Even in times of slavery, we read Edward Baptist. He quoted them. The half has never been told. He talked about how they loved. He had that passage. He talked about how the white slave masters, they used to love to go out and hear the darkies sing their songs for the holidays and such. And of course, they loved to go out and rape them. He talked about that extensively. The market for Negro flesh, right? Places peddling Negro flesh like in New Orleans, Louisiana, known for Negro flesh. That's not separate. She read Edward Baptist, the half is not. That's when anybody says, man, I think this was deliberately done, because if you read Edward Baptist, you know they weren't separate. Rape is how this would have to be described, not separation. Let's see. Forced assimilation, I don't even know what that means. She didn't explain that. She says, it is only the African-American parallel of enslavement, apartheid, and forced assimilation that comes to mind. No idea what that is. Both countries, man, the metaphors abound. Both countries, talking about India and the U.S., both countries still live with the residue of codes that prevailed for far longer than they have not. That's what the problem is in Kentucky, the residue of case codes. Come on. We can be much better with that. And again, that's what I mean about people that are trying to understand racism accurately for the first time, and this is the book that you get? Like, wow. Spasms of resistance. She says, let me get the whole paragraph. While doors have opened to the subordinated case in India and in America in the decades since discrimination was officially prohibited, the same spasms of resistance have afflicted both countries. I mean, what are we talking about, muscle pains? Or are we talking about white people terrorizing black people? Let's see. She writes, I thought this was important, but for not the reasons that she articulates. She says, some observers say that this is what distinguishes the Indian case system from any other, that people in the lower caste accept their lot, that it is fixed and unbending, that Dalits live out their karma decreed by the gods and do their lowly work without complaint, knowing not to dream of anything more. In order to survive, some people in a subordinated caste may learn and believe that resistance is futile. This applies exactly to the United States, and some of this is in a lot of books that we've read. I know I'm thinking explicitly of Solomon Northup, 12 Years a Slave. It's also in Edward Baptist, The Half Has Never Been Told. This is a huge part of white supremacy racism. That's a big part of the religion of white supremacy, often called Christianity. Slave, behave, obey your master, pick as much cotton as you can, corn, whatever it is. And you, when you die, you'll be on a great big plantation in heaven, and everything will be great, and you'll have water, fennel, and plenty. Like they do a lot of that, have done a lot of that to black people for years, where you have tons of black people. Even now, 2020, that's how they think. We just have to accept this. There's nothing that can be done about this. And, you know, we don't want to be militant and unruly and trying to – that is pervasive, that we just are supposed – this is – naturally ordained, manifest destiny, and all of that. So I see quite a bit of that, even now, and explicitly conditioned by white people. As I said, religion of white supremacy. There's a reason white Jews. That's what I say. A lot of this just seems very superficial to me in the way that this is put forward. Continuing. The one see man would have missed Dr. Welsing. She always encouraged studying Nazi Germany. As retired firefighter said, she went to Nazi Germany by request upon graduation. She encouraged, that was one film, it's a documentary, I believe, the WANSEE Conference. I believe it's online. You can check it out, where they kind of go into how they're going to codify white supremacy racism in Nazi Germany. Let's see. Again, when she is talking about these anti-miscegenation laws, in my view, It is done so from an inaccurate perspective. You would have to make sense. Danielle McGuire, Edward Baptist, all of the scholarship about the rape of black people, black males, black females, black children in slavery and beyond. How do you make sense of that within these so-called anti-miscegenation laws? Again, that's what I mean about it is about power. That's the way we've discussed this consistently. It is not. We can't have sex. We can't risk having these mulatto babies. No, 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 no. There's no problem with that. We just can't have marriages. That's what we're not going to have. We're not going to have anything that suggests this is a partnership between equals. We can go over in the bushes and that sort of a thing and on an office table. And that you want this job? Oh, I can bend you over on the washing machine or, you know, rape your son, you know, around the – yeah, no problem. Tons and tons of that. It's not about so-called purity. That's even a pseudoscience, as she said. There's no such thing as that. We make that up as we go. But it's going to be. We can't have this system unless we have tons and tons of us raping non-white people. And I just felt like that wasn't adequately, accurately addressed. Absolutely. For the folks at the Gus T., you're just some loudmouth coon on here. Isabel Wilkerson is a award-winning author, award-winning journalist, has traveled the world, and you're no-count coon stuck in Washington State. Well, we do have a book club, and I told you a lot of the sources that she's citing have been guests on our program, and we've read a number of these books as well. Lothrop Stoddard, mentioned by Silent Warrior, we read that, in fact, right when President Trump was taking office. In the archives, you can visit. Let's see. She said Lothrop Stoddard and Madison Grant, we didn't read The Passing of the Great Race, but retired firefighter did request that one. I'm not sure if that's true. Like, I don't know how you would qualify that these books have been discredited. I mean, I don't know if a major political candidate could come out and say, yeah, I love, like, the rising of rising tide of color against white world supremacy is my Bible. I don't think that could happen. But to me, that doesn't mean it's been discredited. Like, some might say that the bell curve has been, quote unquote, discredited, but that's a bestseller. People still think that way. So I suspect these texts are still very popular. That way of thinking is still obviously very popular and just gets updated with newer scholarship. Let's see. The Menace of the Underman. That's another one. I said, oh, we should maybe read that one too. Lothrop, that would be the third book that I've read by Lothrop Stoddard. I thought this was important because I think Silent Warrior, and please correct me if I'm being in error, but I think Silent Warrior had pointed out before there was a contradiction. She said that racism, white supremacy was worse, or she was suggesting it was worse in the southern states. But when she quoted de Tocqueville, he was saying that racism seemed to be worse in the areas that did not have slavery. Here she says Grant, Madison Grant, went far beyond southern segregationists in his contempt for marginalized people, which I thought that, again, seems to contradict what you said before about racism being worse, so-called, in the U.S. South. Grant argued that inferior stocks should be sterilized and quarantined in a rigid system of elimination of those who are weak or unfit or perhaps worthless race types. Grant published a rabid manifesto of cleansing the gene pool of undesirables in his 1916 book, The Passing of the Great Race. There we go. Let's see. Yeah, we got that. She's had a lot of white people are ignorant, they're unaware, they don't know. There's been a lot of that in this book, and I've just said that that's totally, completely impossible. White people cannot be ignorant about racism. Dr. Welsing talked about this. I'm glad retired firefighter mentioned this. She went to Nazi Germany. Let me study and see this for myself firsthand. She did not come back and, yeah, they were just ignorant, man. Hitler had them fooled. They just didn't know. That was not what I've heard her talk about in terms of her research and study and why she encouraged us to study for ourselves. She said, but Wilkerson writes, the old guard did not foresee or chose not to see. They hear that so common with white people with racism, chose not to see. Come on. By the time they recognized their fatal miscalculation, it was too late. All of that, in my view, is totally false, and it's the same way that people present about white supremacy racism. If you're white, you can't be ignorant about racism. I don't care if they're building billboards that say no niggers or if they're building factories, we're going to burn the Jews. You're not ignorant. Let's see. She mentioned the historian Claudia Kuntz. I've just been so conditioned under white supremacy. Anytime I see Senator Kuntz, Claudia Kuntz, what did you call me? Oh, wait a minute. It's, okay. Just a name. Just a name. It's not even with the coup. It's K-O-O-N-Z, Claudia Kuntz. Anyway. She spends a lot of time on this, even with the warmth of other suns. Like I said, to me, all of this is accurate, right? This is truth. This is based on truthful reports that black people have to use different Bibles and, you know, different bar soap and can't be buried in the same cemetery and blah, blah, blah. All of that is true in many locations, and she spends a lot of time on that in the warmth of other suns. They can't even pass a white person on the highway. But again, the core of that is not the separation. Again, this is at the same time when they brag about the help, when you still got black females who are wet nursing racist white babies, cooking fried chicken for entire white families, raising their white children literally. That's not separation. That is white domination and terrorism. Let's be accurate about what's happening here. All of this emphasis on separation and segregation and all that is not what is happening here at all. Let's see. Definitions. I thought that was so important how she talked about creating legal definitions for what it means to be white, Aryan, Jew, all of that, and then having definitions that are confusing and deliberately so that we can make it anything that we want to as needed. Exactly what racism, what pseudoscience, make it up as we need it. It's whatever we need to continue to dominate you. Let's see. Chapter 9. Now, she has all of this in italics. I don't know why. I thought it might have been a quote from somebody else, but I don't think that's the case. I think this is Miss Wilkerson's writing, but it's in italics. The rest of the text is not. That was a little confusing for me, but continuing. She writes, the girl in the front, she's talking about these lynching photographs, and she has a great piece that she wrote in The Guardian talking about lynching photographs being compared to the police killing videos that are so prominent right now. It's excellent, super accurate. I've posted it repeatedly. I think it was published in 2014 at the time of Michael Brown Jr., and she talks about how these police videos get much greater circulation than the lynching postcards of the early 20th century. Really phenomenal work. But she writes, the girl in the front in this lynching photo is looking up at the dead black man with wonderment rather than horror, a smile of excitement on her face as if show ponies had just galloped past her at the circus. And I just, that metaphor, like I said, the metaphors in this book, there's so many of them, but that metaphor just stuck with me for a moment at a lynching, and that's the metaphor that she inserts, that this is as though show ponies, a black male being lynched, was a similar environment to show ponies running by at the circus. There's a curious metaphor, a way of describing a lynching. Anywho, she talks about the photographers being stationed in advance. This is not ignorance. There's advance notice. That's in the book that I read at the beginning, Red Summer, Cameron McWhirter, white man. He says the same thing. There was advance notice, so we could have the photographers there. A lot of times they would have it in the newspaper, 12 p.m. Thursday afternoon, lynching, be square, be there, be square, like that sort of thing. Not ignorant. But she says the photographers would be there as though it were a prom. That's another metaphor. But I said even with prom, there's a sexual element, right? That's the romantic affair, dance, guy and a gal hooking up. That's sex, male, female. That's sex, as Mr. Fuller says. But that's delectable Negro. As I said, we should think about these lynching incidents as sexual. She's kind of superficially alluding to it that most of the time it was a black, or frequently it would be a black male accused of doing something sexual with a white woman, whether they did or not, many times a lie. But that sex component motivating the terrorism to make sure, and particularly violent control of black males, to make sure that they have been terrorized, and then using that event to terrorize all of the black people. This could happen to you, and sometimes we do go out and kill everybody. But that sexual component, I felt like being minimized, and these lynchings being sexual acts, delectable Negro. She talks about them fighting over the body parts, but she minimized the castration component. Let me get a nigger's penis and put it in a jar. Let me get the nigger's genitals and put it in a jar. How frequent that was, or let me make the Negro eat his own genitals. We talked about that delectable Negro, auto-cannibalism, he called it. That's why I said this is so superficial, particularly given what we have read on, what I think should be said about all of this. This is like really, if you're reading about this for the first time, like you're missing out on a lot. The dots are not being connected properly, if at all, Dr. Welsing metaphor. Delectable Negro, Vincent Woodard, that's in the book club in my top 10 unlike this book. She says, let me give the whole quote. Some people framed the lynching photographs with locks of the victim's hair under glass if they had been able to secure any. One spectator wrote on the back of his postcard from Waco, Texas in 1916, "This is the barbecue we had last night, and my picture is to the left with a cross over it, your son Joe." The barbecue. Delectable Negro, the consumption of the Negro, sexual gratification of the Negro, literally and metaphorically consumption of the Negro. Why would you call it a barbecue? She says, this was singularly American, period. I said, man, I don't think that's accurate, and I think Mr. Fuller suggests caution with using that word American. Are we talking about Brazil? Uruguay? Where are we talking about when we say America? Canada? I thought that was all America. At minimum, it would have to be the area of the world known as the United States. That's if you're saying, you know, lynchings and things that happen in this territory specifically. I guess, but white people have done similar things to black people in other parts of the world. So I guess if we're talking about the lynching, I would suggest not using America. I don't think that's the best word. Let's be more accurate so people don't think we're talking about South America, Central America, like this region known as the U.S. specifically. Let's see. The last one I'll get in, and then I'll double check before we get to the second audio. She mentions Will Brown and this terrorist lynching white mob. They go to kill him. She said that they cut the water hoses to keep the firefighters from putting out the blaze. We have read that so many times. We've read about Mr. Brown's incident before, but white people cutting the fire hoses to prevent a black person's property from being saved? Like, wow. I'm stunned. I think it was some years ago where I started like, wow, that has come up a lot. Like you said, that like standard operating procedure, I guess, if there's a riot and that type of thing breaks out and we get to set a black person's house on fire, there's not going to be any effort to put the fire out. If the fire truck comes, cut the hose. They must have a code about this because I think I could put my hand on at least 5 books where that's come out. I will read one more chunk one more piece from our listener, and then we'll get to the second audio. Chapter 6, The Measure of Humanity. The Indian concept of rankings, however, goes back millennia and is thousands of years older than the European concept of race. Again, it is my understanding that the Dalits with the darkest complexions are typically in the lower caste. Moreover, the author does not comment on whether there was any negative influence by the British upon the Indian caste system during colonization. I would be surprised if there was not any. Number 2, what we face in our current day is not the classical racism of our forefathers' era, but a mutation of the software that adjusts to the updated needs of the operating system. For the dominant caste, the word is radioactive. The author does not define classical racism. I think the metaphor of a mutation is not accurate. Genetic mutations occur spontaneously, often for unexplained reasons. The global system of racism, white supremacy is maintained by willful acts. Changes in the global system of racism, white supremacy are not spontaneous or unexplained. They are willful acts of refinement. The use of the metaphor radioactive is also problematic. Things which are radioactive cause serious harm to people. I am not sure the word racism causes, I'm not sure the word causes serious harm collectively to suspected racists. Number 3, what does racist mean in an era when even extremists won't admit to it? What is the litmus test for racism? Who is a racist in a society where someone can refuse to rent to people of color, arrest brown immigrants in mass, or display a Confederate flag but not be certified as racist unless he or she confesses or is caught using derogatory signage or slurs? The fixation with smoking out individual racists or sexists can seem a losing battle in which we fool ourselves into thinking we are rooting out injustice by forcing an admission that keeps the focus on a single individual rather than the system that created that individual. I do not think renaming racist as dominant caste will prevent racist man, racist woman, racist child from performing acts of racism. I think the author, again, is also trying to make the case that white people are unaware because it is the system, not individual people in the majority of cases, who are to blame. Is it not the system? Is it not the system created and perpetuated by white people? Question. Number four, with no universally agreed upon definition, we might see racism as a continuum rather than absolute. We might release ourselves of the purity test of whether someone is or is not racist and exchange that mindset for one that sees people as existing on a scale based on the toxins they have absorbed from the polluted and inescapable air of social instruction we receive from childhood. It seems that the primary reason that the author is proposing the use of casteism is to make white people more comfortable with their racism. Moreover, after reading this passage, I am not sure whether or not the author believes that non-white victims can practice racism. Number five, caste is a living, breathing entity. Previously, the author stated that caste is rigid and fixed. Living, breathing things change, evolve, age, and are not fixed. This metaphor seems to contradict previous statements by the author. Now, that would be, see, that's something that I would point out as being a bad book. It can't be where the author is contradicting themselves consistently in a different number of ways. Like, that's, and that would be sloppiness to the author, sloppiness to the editor. Number six, casteism is the investment in keeping the hierarchy as it is in order to maintain your own ranking, advantage, privilege, or to elevate yourself above others or to keep others beneath you. I think this may be also be contradictory to the author's thesis that casteism is a system which racists are often unaware of. If racists are invested in maintaining the system, it seems logical that they are aware of it. Just trying to follow logic. Number seven, for this reason, many people, including those we might see as good and kind people, could be casteist, meaning invested in hierarchy. Racists often do things which are helpful to non-white victims. That does not make them kind or good people. It is only indicative of their skill in confusing their victims. I can only highlight again, man, that cowbell rung for a reason. Miss Wilkerson married a white man. I will stop there. We'll get to the second audio segment. If you have additional thoughts, comments, questions, make a note. We should have ample time to share once the second audio segment concludes. It's not too long, so it'll be kind of brief. I'm making shorter sections because, as I said, it seems like we have a lot of interest in this text. It's kind of a newer book, so we'll make time for everyone to share. Context of white supremacy. This is Isabel Wilkerson, Cowbell. Taste, the origins of our discontents. Audio segment number two.
Part three. The eight pillars of caste. The foundations of caste, the origins of our discontents. These are the historic origins, the pillars upholding a belief system, the piers beneath the surface of a caste hierarchy. As these tenets took root in the firmament, it did not matter so much whether the assumptions were true, as most were not. It mattered little that they were misperceptions or distortions of convenience, as long as people accepted them and gained a sense of order and means of justification for the cruelties to which they had grown accustomed, inequalities that they took to be the laws of nature. These are the pillars of caste, the ancient principles that I researched and compiled as I examined the parallels, overlap, and commonalities of three major caste hierarchies. These are the principles upon which a caste system is constructed, whether in America, India, or Nazi Germany. Beliefs that were at one time or another burrowed deep within the culture and collective subconsciousness of most every inhabitant in order for a caste system to function. Pillar number one, divine will and the laws of nature. Before the age of human awareness, according to the ancient Hindu text of India, Manu the All-Knowing was seated in contemplation when the great men approached him and asked him, "Please, Lord, tell us precisely and in the proper order the laws of all the social classes, as well as of those born in between." Manu proceeded to tell of a time when the universe as we know it was in a deep sleep, and the one who is beyond the range of senses brought forth the waters and took birth himself as Brahma, the grandfather of all the worlds. And then to fill the land, he created the Brahmin, the highest caste, from his mouth, the Kshatriya from his arms, the Vaishya from his thighs, and from his feet, the Shudra, the lowest of the four varnas, or divisions of man, millennia ago and into the fullness of time. The fragment from which each caste was formed foretold the position that each would fill and their placement in order in the caste system. From lowest to highest, bottom to top, the Shudra, the feet, the servant, the bearer of burdens, the Vaishya, the thighs, the engine, the merchant, the trader, the Kshatriya, the arms, the warrior, the protector, the ruler, and above them all, the Brahmin, the head, the mouth, the philosopher, the sage, the priest, the one nearest to the gods. The Brahmin is by law the lord of this whole creation, according to the laws of Manu. It is by the kindness of the Brahmin that other people eat. Unmentioned among the original four varnas were those deemed so low that they were beneath even the feet of the Shudra. They were living out the afflicted karma of the past. They were not to be touched, and some not even to be seen. Their very shadow was a pollutant. They were outside of the caste system, and thus outcasts. These were the untouchables, who would later come to be known as Dalits, the subordinate caste of India. In the words of the sacred text of the Western world, the Old Testament, there had been a great flood. The windows of heaven had opened, along with the fountains of the deep, and all of humankind was said to have descended from the three sons of the patriarch Noah. By divine instruction, they survived the floodwaters in an ark for more than 40 days and 40 nights, and thereafter Noah became a man of the soil. His sons were Shem, Ham, and Japheth, who would become the progenitors of all humanity. One season, Noah planted a vineyard, and he later drank of the wine of the fruit of the vineyard. The wine overtook him, and he lay uncovered inside his tent. Ham, who would become the father of a son, Canaan, happened into the tent and saw his father's nakedness and told his two brothers outside. Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it across their shoulders. They walked backward into the tent and covered their father's nakedness. Their faces were turned in the other direction so that they would not see their father unclothed. When Noah awoke from his wine and found out what Ham had done, he cursed Ham's son Canaan and the generations to follow, saying, "Cursed be Canaan, the lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers." The story of Ham's discovery of Noah's nakedness would pass down through the millennia. The sons of Shem, Ham, and Japheth spread across the continents, Shem to the east, Ham to the south, Japheth to the west, it was said. Those who decreed themselves the descendants of Japheth would hold fast to that story and translate it to their advantage. As the riches from the slave trade from Africa to the New World poured forth to the Spaniards, to the Portuguese, to the Dutch, and lastly to the English, the biblical passage would be summoned to condemn the children of Ham and to justify the kidnap and enslavement of millions of human beings and the violence against them. From the time of the Middle Ages, Some interpreters of the Old Testament described Ham as bearing black skin and translated Noah's curse against him as a curse against the descendants of Ham, against all humans with dark skin, the people who the Europeans told themselves had been condemned to enslavement by God's emissary, Noah himself. They found further comfort in Leviticus, which exhorted them, "Both thy bondmen and thy bondmaids, which thou shalt have, shall be of the heathen that are round about you. Of them shall ye buy bondmen and bondmaids." This they took as further license to enslave those they considered religious heathens to build a new country out of wilderness. And thus, a hierarchy evolved in the new world they created, one that set those with the lightest skin above those with the darkest. Those who were darkest and those who descended from those who were darkest would be assigned to the subordinate caste of America for centuries. The curse of Ham is now being executed upon his descendants. Thomas R. R. Cobb, a leading Confederate and defender of slavery, wrote 240 years into the era of human bondage in America. The great architect had framed them both physically and mentally to fill the sphere in which they were thrown. His wisdom and mercy combined in constituting them thus suited to the degraded position they were destined to occupy. Slavery officially ended in 1865, but the structure of caste remained intact, not only surviving, but hardening. "Let the Negro have the crumbs that fall from the white man's table," Thomas Pierce Bailey, a 20th century author, recorded in his list of the caste codes of the American South, echoing the Indian laws of Manu. The United States and India would become, respectively, the oldest and the largest democracies in human history, both built on caste systems undergirded by their reading of the sacred texts of their respective cultures. In both countries, the subordinate castes were consigned to the bottom, seen as deserving of their debasement, owing to the sins of the past. These tenets, as interpreted by those who put themselves on high, would become the divine and spiritual foundation for the belief in a human pyramid willed by God, a great chain of being that the founders would further sculpt in the centuries to follow as circumstances required. And so we have what could be called the first pillar of caste, divine will and the laws of nature, the first of the organizing principles inherent in any caste system. Pillar number two, heritability. To work, each caste society relied on clear lines of demarcation in which everyone was ascribed a rank at birth and a role to perform, as if each person were a molecule in a self-perpetuating organism. You were born to a certain caste and remained in that caste, subject to the high status or low stigma it conferred for the rest of your days and into the lives of your descendants. Thus, heritability became the second pillar of caste. In India, it was generally the father who passed his rank to his children. In America, dating back to colonial Virginia, children inherited the caste of their mother both by law and by custom. And in disputes beyond these parameters, a child was generally to take the status of the lower-ranking parent. The Virginia General Assembly declared the status of all people born in the colony. "Whereas some doubts have arisen whether children got by any Englishman upon a Negro woman should be slave or free," the Assembly decreed in 1662, "be it therefore enacted and declared by this present Grand Assembly that all children born in this country shall be held bond or free only according to the condition of the mother." With this decree, the colonists were breaking from English legal precedent, the only precepts they had ever known, the ancient order that gave children the status of the father. This new law allowed enslavers to claim the children of black women, the vast majority of whom were enslaved, as their property for life and for ensuing generations. It invited them to impregnate the women themselves, if so inclined, the richer it would make them. It converted the black womb into a profit center and drew sharper lines around the subordinate caste, as neither mother nor child could make a claim against an upper caste man, and no child springing from a black womb could escape condemnation to the lowest rung. It moved the colonies toward a bipolar hierarchy of whites and non-whites, and specifically a conjoined caste of whites at one end of the ladder, and at the other end, those deemed black due to any physical manifestation of African ancestry. Tied conveniently as it was to what one looked like, membership in either the upper or the lower caste was deemed immutable, primordial, fixed from birth to death, and thus regarded as inescapable. "He may neither earn nor wed his way out," wrote the scholars Alison Davis and Burley and Mary Gardner in Deep South, their seminal 1941 study of caste in America. It is the fixed nature of caste that distinguishes it from class, a term to which it is often compared. Class is an altogether separate measure of one's standing in a society, marked by level of education, income, and occupation, as well as the attendant characteristics such as accent, taste, and manners that flow from socioeconomic status. These can be acquired through hard work and ingenuity, or lost through poor decisions or calamity. If you can act your way out of it, then it is class, not caste. Through the years, wealth and class may have insulated some people born to the subordinate caste in America, but not protected them from humiliating attempts to put them in their place or to remind them of their caste position. Centuries after the American caste system took shape along the Chesapeake, the most accomplished of lower caste people have often found ways to transcend caste, but rarely to fully escape it. Like the Hindu caste system, the black-white distinction in the United States has supplied a social hierarchy determined at birth and arguably immutable even by achievement, wrote the legal scholars Raymond T. Diamond and Robert J. Cottrell. Blacks became like a group of American untouchables, ritually separated from the rest of the population. In the winter of 2013, the Academy Award-winning actor Forrest Whitaker, a distinguished, middle-aged African-American man, walked into a gourmet delicatessen on the west side of Manhattan for a bite to eat. Seeing it crowded, or not finding what he wanted, he turned to leave without making a purchase, as many customers might. An employee thought it suspicious and blocked him at the door. That level of intervention was uncharacteristic at an establishment frequented by celebrities and college students. The employee frisked him up and down in front of other customers. Finding nothing, he allowed Whitaker, visibly shaken, to leave. The delicatessen owners later apologized for the incident and fired the employee. But the degradation of that moment stayed with the actor. "It's a humiliating thing for someone to come and do that," Whitaker said afterward. "It's attempted disempowerment." Neither wealth nor celebrity has insulated those born to the subordinate caste from the police brutality that seems disproportionately trained on those at the bottom of the hierarchy. In 2015, New York City police officers broke an NBA player's leg outside of a nightclub in Manhattan. The injury left the player, a forward for the Atlanta Hawks, disabled for the rest of the season. It resulted in a $4 million settlement, the proceeds of which the player promptly said he would donate to a foundation for public defenders. In 2018, police officers slammed a former NFL player to the ground after a disagreement he had with another motorist who had thrown coffee at his car, according to news reports. The video that surfaced that spring shows officers twisting Desmond Marrow's arms and legs and shoving him face down onto the pavement. Then they turn him over and hold him down by the throat. He passes out under their weight. After the video went viral, an internal investigation was conducted, and an officer was fired. No matter how great you become in life, no matter how wealthy you become, how people worship you, or what you do, NBA star LeBron James told reporters just the year before, if you are an African-American man or African-American woman, you will always be that.
All right. As I said, shorter session, so we will have time to chat. We'll pick up there next Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Long live Al Sharpton. Let's see. So we'll pick up next week, pillar number 3. If you have commentary to share, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943, pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. If you have not shared at all, please go ahead and get your hand up now. Don't wait till the last minute if you think you have comments that you would like to share. If we didn't get to hear from you at all, definitely hand up. Let's see. All the folks who dialed in who were with us the first time around, Thomas in New York, retired firefighter, silent warrior, our female caller, should all be with us, and then anybody else. I'll keep an eye on the switchboard. We'll get you as well. If you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Henry in Chicago. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. My apologies for being late, but I wanted to comment shortly on the first segment. When the non-white Black professors went and visited the villagers, the Dalit. They started singing liberation songs and, you know, just normal, typical, VGQ, confused people, confused non-white people. They have to sing in order for them to get liberation. So, no surprise there in regards to that. Not very constructive. doesn't sound like there was a very constructive meeting between the Black professors and the Dalit of India. The mention of Lafford Stoddard, you mentioned that in Madison Grant. I also noticed the discredited reputation. I don't think that they were much discredited. Me personally, The Rising Tide of Color was probably one of my favorite books on white supremacy. But what's so interesting is he talked about Stoddard, and he was talking about hate ideology. And so I remember reading that book. Matter of fact, I read that book twice, and I don't remember him saying that he hated, you know, anybody. But I went and did a word search on hate, and I found about 10 instances of hate, and I saw this one in one of his chapters where he specifically said, a symposium of the hate literature of the Great War is unfortunately no part of my task. So Stoddard is telling you right there that it's not about hate, it's just about maintaining white supremacy. So that's what, you know, that book was about. Going into the second, the more recent reading, interesting, she brings up a lot of religious, metaphors, which gets more confusing. But what was so interesting was her bringing up the curse of Ham and how, you know, one of the things, and I've studied this before, but, you know, the curse of Ham was basically kind of started by Jewish interpreters from the Babylonian Talmud, Jewish people that she just referenced in the first reading that was being attacked by the Nazis, that started by 6th century Jewish people who basically said that Ham's skin was cursed, and that is nowhere in the Bible, but they interpreted that, and that's what white people kind of took and, you know, kind of ran with it, metaphor. But I'm surprised, well, maybe I'm not surprised that she didn't mention that, because, you know, many biblical black scholars have pointed that out, like Cain Hofelder, but it was also in the secret relationship of black Jews as well, which was in that book as well. So maybe I'm not surprised, but, you know, obviously we're seeing her intentions, or, you know, maybe confusion on why is she writing this book on caste. But that's all I have on my life.
Much obliged, Henry in Chicago. He was with us. Rising tide of color against white world supremacy. The great Lothrop Stoddard. Other folks with, we should get a biography on Lothrop Stoddard. Like, he is the legend. Like, learn more about his life and time. Anywho, other folks, especially if we missed you totally, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hey, everybody. This caller from 712. I have to go back and listen to the other reading, but every time I hear some, and I hear that a lot, and I guess that's what really happened, but when we say that white people are not ignorant about practicing racism, that's 100% true. So I think it's interesting that people say, well, the Nazis look at the United States to figure out how to practice racism against the people that they call Jews. I just think that's fun. Like, they didn't know what to do with the Jews or the people they call the Jews until they got some type of instructions from how white people was treating black people over here. I don't know if I believe that. I'm pretty sure Germany, white people in Germany, know how to practice racism, white supremacy. And I got to read the book. It was, when I seen the cast, I was like, cast? Isabella Wilkerson? And yeah, I knew it was. But okay, I'm reading it with, you know, I'm listening. Thank you.
Much obliged. That is one of the great mythologies on the planet. Loch Ness Monster, Bigfoot, ignorant white people, or white people ignorant about racism, be specific. And I love a Cal's listener, a Cal's book club participant, going to do a word search in a text. Come back. See, he doesn't even use the word hate, and then explicitly states that he is not down with the hate campaign. Like, words are important. Other folks with a hand up? While people are getting their thoughts together, I'll read some of the folks who wrote in. Like I said, I can't be heard. I hear you, Thomas, in New York. Let's see. We had a female listener. She wrote in, I'm listening to the last week's reading of the book, Cased. It's just so hard to listen to, read her constantly use the word cased for the system of white supremacy. She is really pushing this word cased. Mrs. Wilkerson does not have a good definition of racism. I also wish she would stop using metaphors, because it's giving me a headache to figure out what she's trying to explain. Thank you for having this book on the cows. It reminds us to all have a good definition of racism, white supremacy. If you don't understand white supremacy, racism, everything that you do understand will only confuse you. Neely Fuller is correct. This book confirms the quote that he made. He says all the time, that's why I have this, you know, in the front of the books, I should say, plural. He says it all the time. That's why it's there. That is so fundamental. Like, once you are confused about that, whew, all over the place. Thomas in New York, thank you for your patience, sir.
Absolutely. Mr. Stoddard's book, Rising Tide of Race, I believe it was called. We read the book. And if it wasn't accurate, the man wrote the book, I think, in 1919. And he said in 100 years, the biggest threat to white supremacy is going to be the yellow people, the Chinese people. And if that's not pinpoint accurate, you know, I don't know what is. I think that you find that, especially in the current president, that he's very focused on the yellow people, or more so than anybody else. So I think that his book is very accurate. In fact, I think when we were reading the book, the chapter on the black people was more like pretty much we got them. They ain't no problem. A little bit about the red people, but when he got to the yellow people, that was almost half the book, talking about how they were going to have to defeat them and why. The Jewish scholarship part, I'd be hard-pressed to find any Jewish scholarship, so-called Jewish scholarship, before Solomon Bar Isaacs in the 11th century. It's going to be impossible. Which I don't get the I never got the different races aspect of this. How is, we know white people and black people ain't coming from the same womb. That's just not going to happen. So I don't get that. I never got that, you know, and I never, you know, either way, you can't prove this ever happened either way. But I do see how white people will use that as their justification to practice racism. It seems like they'll find anything, but one of the major things that they've used before the sciences came that did it was the Bible. And, you know, that's, you know, unfortunate. But other than that, I agree that this book is just, it's not being accurate. She's not using the proper wording. And, you know, it's not the worst book ever, but it's just not accurate. But, you know, I mute my line. Thank you, guys.
We still live in a world with the new American classic, The Hate U Give, Nutricide. We got the nutritional Uncle Tom, so no, it is not the worst book in the world, but not
I like The Hate U Give. I mean, it was a good story.
Well, you know. Formerly worst book ever. I cannot say that I enjoyed The Hate U Give movie or book, but yes, there are far worse books than what we are reading now, but reading critically as we proceed. Let's see. Other folks, tragic, right? We got some similarities there. Tragic arrangement, tragic. Anyway, other folks have commentary.
Can I be heard?
Silent Warrior joining us, let's see, Friday morning. 4:40 a.m. Friday morning. Yes, sir.
Okay, some comments on what we've read. I look at this tree that was sitting in the middle of the road that was causing injury and inconvenience to white people. This hanging, this lynching tree, I see it as a symbol of the commitment of the white townspeople to white genetic survival through white supremacy, violence, and terrorism. I read an article earlier where it's recently that suggested that America is losing trillions of dollars due to racism. And I think that that's just the investment, you know, the investment that white supremacists have towards maintaining the system has little to do with their convenience or financial reward. It is because they are interested in dominating and maintaining the system of white supremacy. But of course, from time to time, you have some refinement occurring. And I see that in page 94, where the Postmaster General is banning these postcards with these lynching pictures. I see that as white enforcing a level of refinement on other white people in the system. So, of course, now they have to buy an envelope to put the cards in. ferment, I think, is also happening now with in wake of the Black Lives Matter movement. Anyway, she talks about one of the triggers for these lynchings as resentment that had been building against the influx of Black Southerners. And she wrote a whole book about the warmth of other sons. Why not just call it white resentment? Why not just call it racism? And I realize now that she's holding out hope for the good white person, the rare instance of the good white person. That's probably what that's all about. I saw that you posted that she had been married to a white male, and I realized, and I did some search on the name and her, and I found out that he had passed away 5 years ago from illness. So if that had not happened, she would be still married. In pillars, the first pillar, divine will, laws of nature. If I think about Dr. Welton's work, Dr. Welton says that one of the core pillars of the system of racism, white supremacy, is the myth of white superiority. And this myth of white superiority is part of what supports the idea of like white are good, fair behavior, and so on. And of course, that it's a formation reaction to feeling inadequate due to the fear of white genetic annihilation. So I think Dr. Welton is like light years ahead in her analysis of the system. Okay, and then, that's all I have. You know, I'm interested to read the rest of this book and see what else, what other information can be provided and how I can contrast it and compare it with Dr. Welton and Mr. Fuller's work, primarily, because I still have a lot of catching up to do in the archives. Thank you, Alan Malang.
Still learning. Much obliged, Silent Warrior. Other folks who are with us, if you have commentary, proceed. Get in my other email from listener while I see if folks are getting their thoughts together. All right. Different. Emailer. Greetings, Gus. Chapter 7, Through the Fog of Delhi to the Parallels in India and America. Both exiled their indigenous peoples, the Adivasi in India, the Native Americans in the United States. I think referring to the genocide against Native Americans as exiled is a gross minimization of the actual events. Lots of minimizing, in my opinion, in the book. Number two, perhaps only the Jews have as long a history of suffering for discrimination as the Dalits. The author does not provide any information that the mistreatment of the Dalits in any way compares to the atrocities, pogroms, lynching, medical experimentation, etc., committed against the black people in the U.S. and Jews in Germany. It may be an act of deception not to point this out and an attempt to draw false comparison. Number three, what is called affirmative action in the United States is called reservations in India. In spite of the criticisms by the upper caste, I wonder if the Dalits were the major benefactors of the reservation policy, as opposed to the U.S., in which white women were the main benefactors of affirmative action. I thought that was so important, too. I feel like that's really sloppy scholarship. If it's a non-white person, if it's a white person, they're practicing racism. But if affirmative action is mentioned, it is mandatory, if you are a non-white person and you are informed, to say so-called affirmative action has benefited white people most. And you can include Ellen DeGeneres, white women, white gay people, disabled white people, whatever. Big picture them to make that explicitly. And then to really hammer it home, even after being the biggest benefactors, white women still were right there. Get rid of it? That's right. It's supporting the Negros. But you're the big, shut up. Supporting the Negros. We're get tired of it. Get out of here. Sloppy scholarship, if she doesn't. But again, Elizabeth Wilkerson, like, woo. It'd be hard for me to say that she doesn't know. She has a lot more education than I do. Next, number four, the American system was founded as a primarily two-tiered hierarchy with its contours defined by the uppermost group, those identified as white, and by the subordinated group, those identified as black, with immigrants from outside of Europe forming blurred middle castes that sought to adjust themselves within a bipolar structure. I guess the author is referring to non-white people. I was just going to say, somebody just said immigrants from outside of Europe as middle case, but it is not clear why the author did not include European immigrants who eventually became white in this passage is not clear. I generally think that it's poor writing when people read your work and they consistently say, this is not clear. And it means that whoever edited this did a poor job, or that's what they wanted. Something confusing and not clear. It may be because it undermines the author's theory that the caste is rigid. The blurred middle caste also suggests that the caste system in the U.S. is fluid and not rigid. Chapter 8, The Nazis and the Acceleration of Caste. Number 1, many leading Americans had joined the eugenics movement. Alexander Graham Bell, Henry Ford, Charles Eliot, the president of Harvard. Racist white supremacists often use the tactic of racial focal pointing. You hear that before? To identify the racist as the ones down south who are toothless, ignorant, and draped in the Confederate flag. The danger of this thinking among non-white victims is demonstrated by this passage. I wanted to, Chadwick Boseman, in 42, not the worst film in the world, but there are problems. One of them is there is a line about how black people have a bigger heel bone. It's that same type of eugenics argument. And they laugh at him. And I said, oh, that's not accurate, because that sort of thinking was very common. That was a part of the whole eugenics, you know, the subordinate subhuman Negro. Anyway, Chadwick Boseman. Number 2, Lothrop Stoddard. Many reminders of the cows broadcast in this text. Yeah, reading is more important. Number 3, Nazis never pulled the majority they coveted and drew only 38% of the vote in the country's last free election. Hitler had arisen as an outside agitator, a cult figure enamored of pageantry and rallies with parades of people carrying torches that an observer said looked like the rivers of fire. That's what they said about Charlottesville. If before we go off there, somebody can search. I'll do it myself if I don't have to talk a whole lot. But I think that's what they said about Charlottesville. I think that's, man, I'd be willing to wager, how much money would I be willing to put on? I'd be willing to wager $50 US. If somebody can look, I think they use, if you put in rivers of fire, put that in quotes, do a search, so rivers of fire, and then just see if Charlottesville pops. I think you could do it naked. That way, I was going to say you could do quotes around rivers of fire, then put Charlottesville. But I'd put $50 down that you could do a search, rivers of fire, Charlottesville 2015, Heather Hare will pop up. Please, if somebody has the time and the free energy, free hand to do a little typing, let's see. But anyway, rivers of fire. Hitler saw himself as the voice of the bulk of their grievances and fears, especially those in the rural districts, as a God-chosen savior running on instinct. He had never held elected office. The author is reinforcing often-mentioned parallels between Hitler and Trump. Number 4, what the Nazis could not understand, however, was why in America the Jews were also of interest to us are not reckoned among the coloreds, when it was so obvious to the Nazis that the Jews were a separate race, and when America had already some aversion by imposing quotes on Jewish immigration. Oh, wait a minute, got too far. Sorry. We did read chapter 8. Sorry. Thinking I got ahead. Let's see. When it was so obvious to the Nazis that Jews were a separate race, and when America had already shown some aversion by imposing quotas on the Jewish immigration. This fact was often remarked upon by Dr. Welsing, that the Nazis persecuted the Jews because they were not white, emphasizing that race is the most important factor in a caste system engineered by white people. Chapter 9, The Evil of Science. Number one, this was singularly American. Even the Nazis did not stoop to selling souvenirs of Auschwitz. The Nazis found a more practical purpose for those they murdered. They made furniture out of them. The furniture can be viewed at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., once the Rona is over. I did want to say, the folks, I think someone did call in and say, I don't think the Nazis needed any help in knowing how to mistreat Jews. They did have concentration camps on the continent of Africa. There is lots of, it's in Military History Quarterly, where they went and killed like huge numbers, total genocide of black people. This is like in the southern portion of the continent. This is decades before Nazi Germany. So no, I did not, and I didn't hear any, yeah, we had to go and study what they were doing down in Alabama, and then we went over, we took it to those coons on the guy. Like, I've never heard that. They know how to mistreat people. Continuing. Number two, excerpts from the text. In downtown Omaha, they started a bonfire and readied it for William Brown. As many as 15,000 people gathered, a black man had molested her. A 14-year-old boy was helping his father across the street in the middle of the riot. Henry Fonda, it was the most horrendous sight I've ever seen, he would say years later. The author does not address why there are no examples of similar atrocities against Dalits. In addition, the celebration of such terror by a racist man, racist woman, and racist child, lynching postcards, is also apparently not seen in India with regards to Dalits. Pillar number one, divine will and the laws of nature. The United States and India would become, respectively, the oldest and largest democracies in human history, both built on caste systems, undergirded by their reading of the sacred text of their respective cultures. To call the U.S. a democracy, given all the examples the author has provided in this text and her other works regarding the historical and continued domination mistreatment of black people, is so contradictory to be ludicrous. Dr. Welsing would point that all the time. This is not a democracy. Pillar number two, heritability. It is the fixed nature of caste that distinguishes it from class, a term to which it is often compared. Class is an altogether separate measure of one's standing in a society marked by level of education, income, and occupation. Through the years, wealth and class may have insulated some people born to the subordinate caste in America, but not protected them from humiliation, attempts to put them in their place, or to remind them of their caste position. The author implies that whites and non-whites can be part of the same class. For the dominant caste in America, class is irrelevant regarding mistreatment of their non-white victims. The author continues to attempt to characterize the U.S. caste system as rigid and fixed, which I would argue it is not. Forrest Whitaker. Number two, centuries after the American caste system took shape along the Chesapeake. I did want to stop right there. Forrest Whitaker is kind of a big dude, unless I've been mistaken, like folks who've seen him in films. Like, I thought people were all afraid of the big, burly, grizzly, black male rapist. You mean someone jumped up? Hey, back down, coon. Stole a sandwich, didn't you? Scary black male, yes. Number two, centuries after the American caste system took shape along the Chesapeake, the most accomplished of lowercase people have often found ways to transcend caste. How does a lowercase person transcend caste? It would be, oh, now see, that's the type of thing I generally would say, cowbell, like, come on. It would be helpful if the author had given an example. Did President Obama transcend the case? White mother. Did the author transcend the case? Cowbell. Kudos to the listener who found that Ms. Wilkerson is divorced from a suspected racist. I was suspicious but was unable to verify. I can't say I was surprised, not that she was with a white man. I mean, system of white supremacy, why would that be surprising? But I was surprised. We spent an entire season. Like, it took us, I think, more than 3 months to read The Warmth of Other Suns. It is a long book. 15 years it took her to write. I'm stunned that at no point no one, like, stumbled on her Facebook page or found something. Like, they have public photographs. Like, no one, myself included. Oh, she's married. I mean, still top 10. It's amazing. I'm just stunned. Nobody. And even in the subsequent years that I've referenced it, and nobody found until now. But I am glad to know. We will keep that in mind as we continue. And as I said, it's going to come up like explicitly in the text, I think, like a lot of comparisons to The Hate U Give. Did anybody have a final thought they need to get in last minute, or are we satisfied for this week? Everybody good? I didn't even share my notes from the second portion. I will just say impregnate. I could have said a lot of things. The word impregnate, she says, and I'll even pause, one of the best books that I've read on so-called enslavement or making black people slaves in this part of the world, The Slave Coast, Ned and Constance Sublett. They were guests on the program in 2016, February, the day after the Super Bowl. Cam Newton was defeated. Excellent book, and it's all about rape, how rape of black females was required, an institutional requirement to maintain slavery in this part of the world. Rape. That's the word that they use consistently, rape, rape, not impregnate, but to say the ancient order that gave children the status of the father, this new law allowed enslavers to claim the children of black women, the vast majority of whom were enslaved, as their property for life and for ensuing generations. It invited them to impregnate the women themselves. If a white person had said that, I'd say that's a flagrant act of racism, and in fact, a lot of white authors, I think even Edward Baptist and a number, he was on the program. He's at the University of Texas, the heart of white, Elliot Jasmine. He'll come to me in a second, I think. But we've had a number of white guests who've come on the program, and they will say, oh, yeah, that's rape, not impregnate. Minimizing. Very, very common in the system of racism, white supremacy, impregnate. Disgraceful. That's what time, a lot of times, again, it's impregnating a child. It's Thomas Jefferson being 40 and Sally Hemings being 14. That's impregnating. Anyway, I thought, again, they said, say her name. Isn't that what they say? Sandra Bland, say her name. Breonna Taylor, say her name. I'm not mocking it. That's what they say, right? So she says in 2015, New York City police officers broke an NBA player's leg outside of a nightclub in Manhattan. The injury left the player, a forward for the Atlanta Hawks, disabled for the rest of the season. It resulted in a $4 million settlement, the proceeds of which the player promptly said he would donate to a foundation for public defenders. He doesn't have a name? I thought the jerseys, they normally at least have a surname, right? We could have at least got that. He does, like, he donates the money. He doesn't go to the strip club. He doesn't spend it on white women and cocaine. He's going to donate the money, and we can't even get his name? Sloppy at minimum. Like, it's not the worst book I've ever read, but it's really, really bad. Like, if I had paid money to get this, this would, I would say, be in the running for the second book of the year to burn. Like, man, 2020 has been awful. We will wrap there. We'll continue next week. We are reading this to completion. This is important just for election season, especially if this was something to get us to cast a ballot for Kamala. Like, come on. The only other thing I'll say, I do think it is fascinating. We are reading this book. It's been reported India is about to overtake the United States for COVID-19 cases. That is astounding, given how bad this has been the whole time, and a super non-white area of the world in terms of non-white population. That bad in terms of the response. So now we would be India, the United States, Brazil. Think about those ramifications for a second. Anywho, we will be here tomorrow for Neutralizing Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Much obliged for folks tuning in. Untiljustice@gmail.com if you want to write in. Tried to get, I think I got most of it, if not all the written emails. Much obliged. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We need our brain computer. There's lots of confusion to try to figure out. Need that brain computer working well. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle. I would still encourage us to hunker down. It is super dangerous. If you got to go out, you're sober. You are buckled. You are alert. If you are behind the wheel, you're not on the phone because we got to be looking out. Armed white person, vigilantes, river of fire. And we're trying to minimize contact with race soldiers. As we have seen, very likely they will kill you and nothing will be done about it. As usual, Will Brown all over again. Try to minimize the likelihood of it being you. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
no
brother.
Problem. A victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.